Call the House Health and Human Services Committee to order this Friday, May 20th, 2005. We have a varied program. We have to accept the report from the Department of Human Services that was required of us based on legislation from a previous assembly. So we're going to start with that informational meeting, and hopefully some other additional members will show up and get us to a point where we can conduct our work sessions on the Adult Foster Home Bill and the Automated External Defibrillator Bills. We'll get those out of the way so that we can then proceed on to our panel on mental health parity. There are four bills listed on the agenda in the area of mental health parity, one of which is a House Joint Memorial discussing mental health parity for veterans on the veterans level. A memorial is a tool the legislature employs to send messages to the Congress on important issues that the legislature feels needs to be advanced. The proponent of that measure has until we start the discussions to hear that. Otherwise, we won't be hearing that measure. They have, in other words, 15 minutes to get here. And the legislature, the House of Representatives has recessed. We stood in recess at about 10 o'clock. We still have about 90 minutes of work to complete today. We were going to be called back in at 11:30, so it may just be me at 11:30 on to listen to some folks, but we're going to really have to take a look at our timelines. So I do encourage you, if you have written testimony, not to read your written testimony. Summarize what the important points that you want to get to us on mental health parity and turn in your written testimony, and we will very carefully look at it. If there's anybody that doesn't have an opportunity to testify and get their comments in, submit. We will keep the submit written testimony. We'll keep the record open through the weekend and forward as we decide what the next steps of this legislation are going to be. And it's imperative that if you wish to testify here this morning on mental health parity, that you sign up on one of the sign-up sheets before we start the work session, the public hearings, so that I can take a look at how many people would like to speak and plan appropriately for the time, because we do have pretty significant time constraints. So with that, we'll invite Mr. Bob Nickel with the Department of Human Services Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services forward to give us his presentation on the Planning of Local Mental Health Services Report. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to announce for the audience benefit, there is an overflow room in the orientation. The Capitol Orientation Room is the overflow room. So if anybody feels this room is too crowded, we're carried over to the orientation room. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Nickel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and member of the committee and committee administrator. My name is Bob Nickel, and I'm the administrator of the State Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. And I'm here simply to transmit the committee to the committee the department's report to the Oregon Legislature on the progress of the planning for local mental health services. This is a required report based on House Bill 3024 from a couple of sessions ago. It's the outcome of a previous governor's mental health task force and mental health alignment work group. And basically what the report does in about 10 pages is summarizes how we've gone about doing local mental health planning, the methods by which we tried to coordinate that with other entities locally, like local alcohol and drug planning councils, etc. And then it lists some of the key issues and initiatives that we've been planning for, namely outcomes from the governor's mental health task force. That's Governor Kulikowski's mental health task force, evidence-based practices, the Children's Mental Health System Change Initiative, and the Oregon State Hospital Master Plan. And rather than go into any more detail, I would just ask if there are any questions. I would be happy to answer them, and you will probably want to read the report later.
Thank you, Mr. Nickel. I was banking on you going at least another 3 or 4 minutes so we could get some members down here to vote on some bills, but I see that's not in the cards this morning. So,
Mr. Chair, you could ask me 3 minutes of questions.
Well, could you maybe do a little dance or something?
Do I have to?
No, sir, you do not. Why don't you tell us about, briefly, where we are, what the status is of the Oregon State Hospital Master Plan Steering Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as all of you on the committee were aware, and actually most of you attended, we had a joint committee hearing on Monday to release the Phase 1 report of the Oregon State Hospital Master Plan. I think there's been plenty of coverage in the news since then about it. So I think what I would emphasize is that it's clear from the architectural engineering review and the system review that we have a major structural problem, particularly with the J complex building. In the event of a seismic event of 6.2 or higher, there's a likelihood that that building in part would collapse. And so we're doing contingency planning now to see what the options are for moving 100 forensic patients to another setting as quickly as we can. It's a fairly complicated kind of process, and I won't try to go into it in detail, except to say we're looking at any kind of facility of any kind in the state that might be able to become available. But I would emphasize that, at least for the record now, that I think the cost of renovating anything that's currently available so that it could fit the needs of patients that we would have is going to have a several million dollar price tag just to get into something. So I don't think it's going to be simple, but we are looking at whatever the possibilities might be.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Nickel. With that, we'll conclude the informational meeting on the local mental health services planning report. I wanted to do a work session on those first two bills because we've already worked them and they're just waiting for some amendments. They're ready to go, but we don't have a quorum to be able to do that. So
we called.
Yeah, and we did call. All right, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2913, open a public hearing on House Bill 3444, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All three of the bills are relating to group health insurers from imposing any treatment limitations, limits on total payments, or financial requirements on coverage, insurance coverage for chemical dependency, which includes alcoholism and for mental or nervous conditions, unless similar limitations or requirements are imposed on coverage of other medical conditions. They have an effective date of January 1, 2007. House Bill 3444 has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, as does Senate Bill 1.
Thank you, Sandy. Maybe you'll stand at ease for a moment. Order, we will suspend or recess the public hearing on 2913, on 3444, Senate Bill 1, and open a work session on 3482. Sandy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, you will recall we had a public hearing on this bill on Wednesday the 18th. At that time, we had several amendments. What's before you in a hand engrossed is the combined amendments with some additional changes. The additional changes include the request to exempt non-health club type of facilities that have exercise rooms, as well as we put in further clarified that a health club addresses a facility that has 100 or greater persons on any regular business day. This did have an IM passing around a -7 that we just got that adds one word into new section 6 on page 3 on lines 24H. We're just adding, including an exemption of employees does not count as part of the 100 person per day requirement. So that one would replace the -6. We got we requested a rescind for the budget referral. We did receive that, so the bill is ready to go as amended if that's the committee's choice. And you also have in your packet a fiscal impact statement that just clarifies how the funding mechanism through the Department of Education will be their anticipated actions for the Department of Education to implement the program for the automated external defibrillators through the school systems.
Okay, so colleagues, we have the dash sevens in front of us, which are the final clean version of amendments to this bill. The dash sevens from the from 3482, as it's written, they remove the tampering language, which is unnecessary. They add a couple of names. I think we're adding the name of Eddie Barnett, and we're adding the name of an individual in the Kirk Spencer in the Memorial Act section of the health club part of that bill, and we are adding health clubs larger than having 100 or more employees, patrons, or members participating on a regular business day. So really targeting this at large health clubs, that they will have to have an automated external defibrillator device present and available for use. And then we clarified the question of what constitutes a health club versus what constitutes an exercise facility at a sub facility at operations that might have exercise venues that are not primarily health clubs, such as country clubs, hotels, apartment complexes, and so forth. So, colleagues, we have a polished dash seven. The dash seven differs from the dash six in that we have added on line 19 the word employees. Employees on line 19. So that means that if you have basically 100 or more people on the premises in a business day, you're going to need one of these external defibrillator devices. So I hope that we're ready to go. We're ready to rescind. So Representative Greenlick, may I have a motion?
Yes, Rick. Sir. I move the dash 7 amendments to House Bill 2482.
Thank you, Representative Greenlick. Representative Greenlick moves the dash 7 amendments to House Bill 3482. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, the dash 7 amendments are ordered adopted. Representative Greenlick.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3482 as amended with the dash 7 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation, rescinding future referrals to other committees.
Thank you, Representative Greenlick. Representative Greenlick moves House Bill 3482 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Budget be, or to the Committee on Budget be rescinded. Is there discussion? Seeing no discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Anderson?
Excused.
President Boone?
Aye.
President Cameron?
Aye.
President Greenwood?
Aye.
President Tomei?
Excused.
President Butler?
Excused.
Chair Dalto?
Chair votes aye. Please return to Representative Anderson.
President Anderson?
How do you vote?
Yes. Aye.
Representative Anderson votes aye. House Bill 3482 as amended has received a constitutional majority and is declared passed. Representative Hass will be attached to carry this measure. Yes, and we will close the work session on House Bill 3482. Open a work session on Senate Bill 430. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 430 had a public hearing on the 9th of May. This is requiring continuing education for adult foster home providers and resident managers. It has no revenue or fiscal impact, and there are no amendments on the bill.
Colleagues, you recall that we had this bill last week on the continuing education requirements. There was some discussion about the total hours of continuing education, and that a portion of those hours for these providers should be directed at business operations and learning how to run a business for adult foster home providers. So the bill is clean. There were any objections? There are no amendments. I'll entertain a motion on Senate Bill 430, please.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 430 as amended to the House floor with a due pass.
This is 430A.
430A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Cameron. Representative Cameron moves Senate Bill 430 to the floor, 34A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing no objection, clerk, call roll.
President Anderson?
Aye.
President Boone?
Aye.
President Cameron?
Aye.
President Greenwood?
Aye.
President
Tomei? Excused.
President Butler?
Excused. Chair votes aye. Senate Bill 430A, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Entertain a motion for placing that on a consent calendar.
So moved.
Representative Anderson moves that Senate Bill 430 be placed on a consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Without objection, Senate Bill 430 is ordered placed on a consent calendar. That will close the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 430. Open, return to our public hearing on House Bill 2913, House Bill 3444, Senate Bill 1. And these are the mental health parity bills. We will invite Representative Linda Flores and Representative Dane Hunt forward, please. And for the members of the audience, Senate Bill 1 and House Bill, all these three measures are effectively the same, so you can speak to one and it'll be like you're speaking to all of them. So good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Linda Flores and I'm State Representative for House District 51. I am here to speak in support of the mental health parity bills. I am an ardent supporter so that those members of our society who are dealing with mental health issues will have the coverage that has been so significantly lacking for their ongoing treatment and care. I know that there, our friends across the table are concerned about the pressures that this would create as far as insurance rates, but I'm just urging that we all continue to explore the necessity of this very important issue. I also would note for the record that the President has spoken of his support for mental health parity. I know that it is a pressure point in our whole system, whether it's the correction system, our mental health services system, and even in our education system. So it is a definite need of a fix, and I'm very supportive of whatever efforts we can achieve here in this session. With that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I would conclude my comments. Thank you for your consideration of this very important and timely issue, and I would take my leave.
Thank you very much, Representative Flores. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Representative Hunt, good morning. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Dave Hunt, also from Clackamas County. I applaud you for having hearings on these three critically important bills today. Mental illness has impacted my family, my immediate family, directly. And I've seen firsthand the benefits of mental health treatment, counseling, medication, and how that has taken mental illness and put it in a context where adults and children, even within my immediate family, are able to function in completely effective ways as students, as employees, and as partners. I am fortunate to have health insurance that has mental health coverage. And the challenge for us is that many Oregonians do not have the benefit of having mental health coverage as part of their insurance.
No, I have to go.
And this is a critical opportunity to restore that challenge, to make it clear that mental illness is as important as any physical ailment, that covering mental health is as important as covering physical health. Now, I'll tell you that I'm not a big fan of government mandates. But I think there are certain times when we need to step up and recognize that certain things are important enough to require even a government mandate. The added cost of adding mental health coverage, as I'm sure you'll hear in other testimony to come, are minuscule compared to the benefits. The benefits in terms of effective lives, even the fiscal benefits in terms of having far more constructive students, more constructive employees, more constructive business owners. The support for this is abundantly clear. As you know, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 1 passed the Senate with only 6 no votes, overwhelming bipartisan vote. House Bill 2913 that Representative Tomei and I joined with 20 other bipartisan legislators to introduce is also before you. So I urge you to take urgent action on behalf of my constituents, on behalf of your constituents. We've got a real opportunity this session to make a major beneficial public policy change, and the need could not be more critically urgent. The support could not be broader and deeper for this bill, and I would urge you to take Senate Bill 1 and to forward it to the floor as soon as possible with the due pass recommendation. Thank you again for taking the time and for having me here.
Thank you very much, Representative Hunt. Are there questions or comments? Seeing none, thank you. We will open a public hearing on House Joint Memorial 24. Welcome Representative Donna Nelson forward. This is the bill that urges Congress to provide parity in mental health care and make veterans' mental health care benefits similar to benefits for physical care. Good morning. Welcome, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of this committee. The time is now to support the previous mentioned bills, which I support in entirety. I have been an advocate to get support for those suffering mental illness as long as I've been here in the legislature in 1975, so my gosh, 30 years ago. I was proud to be a co-founder of Poyamaland, the treatment center for severely emotionally disturbed children at Independence, and really proud to have named it after Polk, Yamhill, and Marion counties. I'm so grateful that that facility has helped so many children. At that time, 30 years ago, we were still even hesitant to say someone needed help for mental illness. I'm proud of the parents who realized that they had a child who needed help and bravely took it on themselves to participate in our program at Poyamaland. Today, I'm here also in support of House Joint Memorial 24 that will afford mental health parity for our veterans and our military. And just a quick mention, I don't even think I need to really talk about this too much because any soldier or airman who goes to war comes home changed. Every veteran who's ever served in our armed forces suffers some type of mental illness. Why we have delayed in Congress in supporting these individuals with the proper coverage for mental illness is beyond my comprehension. But a lot of things are, just like the non-permanent funding of other health services for our veterans. I'm asking that you join with us in requesting that Congress understand the 100% effect of war to the mental health, the good mental health of our veterans and our military. And frankly, just to mention briefly, we had 10,000 serving from our Northwest. We have 50 who are returning home with severe brain injuries. We have over 250 amputees. Catastrophically, I should have said catastrophic amputations. And we also have a tremendous number of individuals who already have sought mental health services. And I would just like at this time to praise White City and Roseburg and the Portland VA Hospital. Particularly, I want to thank White City and Roseburg for extending coverage right now for every returning veteran, whether or not the federal government acknowledges it or not. They're taking a risk, but they know it's absolutely required. And also I might mention that the Iraqi war has stirred up the trauma our Vietnam veterans suffered, and we now have them alarmingly in large numbers seeking mental health services. So not only do we have those currently in war, we have those in previous wars who are now reliving their days of horror and terror. Thank you very much for supporting us in this mission.
Thank you very much. Questions for Representative Nelson, Representative Greenlink.
Good morning, Representative Nelson. Did you have testimony in your committee that the returning veterans weren't currently receiving mental health services?
Yes, sir, that is true. Chair Dalto, Representative Greenlick, that is true.
And they, they weren't receiving them because they weren't covered or because there wasn't VA capacity or what?
Thank you, Chair Dalto, Representative Greenlick. That is true. We have a lack of capacity, and also many of our plans do not cover, and they're all varied. All vary in the types of benefits. So you have to recall, perhaps from my testimony yesterday on the House floor, that a lot of these individuals are not called veterans yet. And because they've not served 180 days or longer, they get different types of treatment. For example, our Oregon Guard, returning from the war, after their original week home, have no medical insurance, period.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up?
Yes.
Well, We did have a resolution on the floor that talked about, which I supported strongly, talked about making sure returning guardsmen were treated as veterans. But this resolution is about veterans coverage. And essentially, my experience has been that the veterans covered by the VA are covered for mental health services exactly the same as physical health services.
Chair Dalto, Representative Greenlick, they are not. And I'd ask you to call the VA hospital. We had extensive testimony. In fact, we had Admiral Johnson even come from TRICARE, TriWest. The good news that may have happened, and I appreciate the help of our congressional delegation as we've talked to them over the period of this session, we have made a giant step recently. I've not seen the funding. I have great concerns because I did receive a press release on Monday, or Tuesday it was, that our benefits were cut after we just had hope of having complete coverage for mental health problems.
You mean our services were cut?
Yes.
Or our benefits?
Both. The funding, whatever they determined to cut, Representative Greenlight, you know, is what is was gone. And call it a benefit of the service. But if there aren't funds available to provide, you know, the service, it's not going to happen.
So would you accept, if I may, an amendment to this memorial that talks about funding cuts as opposed to benefit coverage? I mean, my experience is benefits are covered for veterans for mental health.
Representative Dalto, I'd be happy to consider anything, but I don't think it's necessary because today on the floor of the House, we passed a memorial asking for permanent full funding of the benefits for veterans. We just want to be sure, just like dental coverage, which was not previously covered up until, in fact, our Clackamas troops left Clackamas for training and then on to Iraq without knowing. They now have 90 days prior to deployment and 90 days after deployment to get dental services. Many of them went over with problems. They did not have mental health services.
I'm glad that our action on the floor today solved this problem. So this memorial may not be necessary since we've solved the problem with the memorial.
Chair Dalto, Representative Greenlick, that's not what I said. What I said was our services, this bill asks for coverage of mental health illness.
I understand this bill.
If we could get that in there, okay. That would greatly help us.
Representative Nelson, thank you so much for bringing the bill forward. We appreciate your testimony this morning. Thank you. Representative Buckley. Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Dalton, members of the committee. I came to deliver written testimony on the mental health parity bills, to offer my strong, strong support of those bills, and to thank you personally for taking the time to listen to these bills. I won't take any more of your time in deference to the many people who are waiting to testify.
Representative Buckley, we have your testimony here. Appreciate you sharing your story about your supporter and friend in the Ashland community that lost your life. So thanks for bringing it forward. I know that it's a very important issue for you and your community and for the state, so thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
And Representative Buckley, I just read that too. The same thing happened to me on Friday, and exactly the same thing, and I am not going to get up and testify, but I have had that experience just recently.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. Marion County Commissioner Janet Carlson. Good morning, Commissioner. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Dalto and members of the committee. I'm
looking. You'll keep it short, right?
Yeah. Right, exactly. And I'm looking. Do you have a packet that looks like this? There's someone getting that for you. They're coming right there. Okay, my testimony is coming. I'm here to speak on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties and also Marion County to say that we're in support of mental health parity. We took a vote at AOC. It was really a historic vote. In the past, AOC has been neutral, and this year AOC says that we need this mental health parity. Our jails are becoming mental health centers. I'm sure this is not the first time time you've heard that. This bill will not necessarily help the people who are in jail because they are usually not working, nor are they on the Oregon Health Plan. However, it will prevent people from going into the institutions, help support them when they come out, so that they will have the medications that they need and won't become criminals and offend. So we also, there's some very compelling information here that talks about other states that have done this, and the sort of the sky is falling arguments that you may hear about, you know, that this isn't a good idea. The cost, the increase of cost was less than 1% in other states, so it's not a huge increase in cost, nor were there very many employers that dropped insurance because of this bill in other states. Also, our own Oregon public employees that have been on it have also found that it has very minimal impact. So I'd like to urge your support of mental health care.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Carlson. Questions for the Commissioner?
Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. Okay, folks, we have about 25 people signed up, and we're going to devote about an hour to this presentation. The problem with recessing the meeting is that we could recess the meeting, but it would be at least 2 o'clock before we could come back and complete, you know, additional testimony from folks. So I think we should just try to cover it in an hour. Otherwise, people are going to be waiting a really long time.
What time are we due back on the floor?
We're due back at the floor at 11:30, and I'm just going to release the members of the committee to go back on the floor, and I'll just get excused, even though I don't want to miss votes. But it's important to accept the testimony of folks. We hadn't anticipated that we would be called back to the floor at 11:30, and that's the problem when we set this meeting, and that just was the decision was made a few moments before we started. So. Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I just suggest that if folks are covering an issue that's already been covered, to maybe defer to those who've already testified?
Yeah, I think that's a good suggestion, and people are probably going to be cognizant of that. So let's get into this. Let's see how it goes and reassess about halfway through. That sound reasonable? Okay. All right. I would like to invite Jonathan Ader forward, Gene Thorne, and Kathy Larrabee.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Jonathan Ader. I was co-chair of the governor's 2004 mental health task force. I'm also a member of the legislator's health policy commission, on which I serve with the chairman and Representative Greenlick. My written testimony is the report of the governor's mental health task force, which I trust you've all seen. Our very first of 50 recommendations is adoption of a mental health parity bill of the form that you have in front of you. There are many reasons for that. Many of them are fairness and equity reasons, about which I know you're going to hear eloquent testimony. I want to talk to you just briefly about the importance of this as a policy matter in terms of aligning responsibility for the care of individuals, where right now we have a disconnect between people that are part of the employer-based system when they have a physical illness, but part of the public health system when they have a mental illness, and as a result there's a lack of any kind of accountability for outcomes. This is a step towards fixing that. It's not going to fix all of it, either for mental health or some of the other issues we need to work on as a state, but this is an essential and important building block, and I urge you to pass it and to move it forward, and then we can begin moving other steps. I'm not going to take more time. There are lots of people that have come a long ways with important stories to tell. I have said to the chair and to the committee administrator, I'm available to assist you all and give you some of the background that we developed on the task force, if you wish. Thank you very much.
And Mr. Ader, we've had in previous meetings excessive testimony on the governor's recommendations from the task force, the mental health task force.
Right.
So this panel is pretty familiar with that, so I appreciate you pointing that out for us.
And I note, in fact, that we're moving collectively on the hospital recommendations, which are extremely important in the building of community facilities. This is all of a piece. We have to address all of these things to make sense of this.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Damiana Merriweather. I'm just here on behalf of Administrator Gene Thorne from the Public Employees Benefit Board. I have submitted to you a very brief written statement from them on their experience of implementation. The administrator has deferred her time here for the public, but has placed information for contact for further information about their experience with implementation at PEB on this material. The takeaway point is that their experience with implementation in the first year has been 1/4 of 1% of an increase in overall premium impact. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kathy Larrabee. I'm a small business owner, not that small, but small business owner in Portland. My husband and I have a son who is now 21 and was diagnosed with schizophrenia at 17. We really represent the stories of many other families, as I'm sure you're well aware, who've had similar experience on private insurance and a mental health system. I'm going to make a shortcut to our situation and compare it to I had cancer of the finger, of all wonderful things, a year of chemo, all covered by our insurance, which is through the National Association of Self-Employed. However, when my son was hospitalized for his schizophrenia, his lifetime benefits were up after 10 days, even though he was hospitalized two times for a total of 30 days and then went to Oregon State Hospital for 6 months, where at age 17, we basically, in order to get the services, kind of had to relinquish custody, which many families have had this experience. So some of the surprises, first of all, we had made many changes to try to find out what was going on with our son. We went to doctors and psychiatrists, sold businesses, moved from the coast to Portland to find better services, stayed home instead of working so that we could care for him when he was home, and we're very fortunate. We were lucky, and I think about many families who don't have the independence that we had to be able to make that choice of staying home and helping to care for our son. We only have one son. Single families and those with more children, I don't know how they do it, frankly. The other surprise is, even though our premium is that $1,500 a month, and yet he has no benefits any longer. He's still on our policies. He's 21. The good news is he's on a non-therapeutic dose of medication. He's in his third year as a full-time student at Portland State University, doing very well, living on his own, very independent, and he was worth it. And I would think that many other families who haven't had the opportunities he has had, they're worth it too. And they need the support of charity. Thank you.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Is it your understanding that the passage of one of these measures would actually provide additional coverage for your son?
Not any longer.
In the circumstance that you described. I mean, he was stopped, I suppose, after 10 visits, I think, was your testimony.
He was in the hospital for 2 weeks and went home, made a serious suicide attempt and was returned for another 2 weeks. And we're still paying for that hospitalization.
But my question was, the passage of this bill, would it have the practical effect of having continued the coverage that your son stopped receiving after a certain period of time?
My understanding is that that he would get the same care as if he had had a terrible car accident and needed to be hospitalized for major medical. Does that answer your question?
Another question is, so you receive your health care benefits then through the National Association of the Self-Employed.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a group health policy that you bought through them?
We bought it about 15 years ago. Now, I used to be I moved from being a school administrator, which had wonderful insurance, to self-employed, and yes, part of a group.
Okay, thank you very much. I think, are there any other questions or comments from this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Yes, sir. One observation, Chris. I think your last question was getting to ERISA plans. are not subject to Oregon state legislation, so that the passage of this bill would not address a parity issue with respect to ERISA-based coverage, which is one of the reasons why it doesn't begin to solve all of the problems. But it is an important step, and the fact that that doesn't occur doesn't mean that this bill should not be passed for the effect that it has.
Thank you, Mr. Ader. And so my point was, I suspect that that was an ERISA-based plan, and I just want to be sure that when folks are coming forward and explaining their personal stories and telling us very difficult personal stories about family members that are suffering, or self-advocates coming forward and telling us about their situations, I want to make sure that the passage of this bill, people understand that in those personal circumstances of employer-based insurance policies, I mean, we want to be clear about the benefits that, that Senate Bill 1 is bringing forward and the benefits that aren't being brought forward to specific cases. That's my point, but thank you very much for clarifying.
Mr. Chair, could,
yes,
you,
Representative Bruner.
Could you describe ERISA, please?
Mr. Ader, do you want to?
Briefly, ERISA is the Employment Retirement Income Security Act, and because I have a law degree, I can say that much, but I can't tell you what it is. It's the federal law that regulates pension and benefit plans that are federally chartered, so that various plans, union, trust, joint employer union trust agreements, for example, are subject to ERISA, not subject to regulation as an insurance company in order.
All self-insured plans are
That's right. Self-insured plans.
This bill will not touch any self-insured plan. It won't touch half-heartedly trust.
Any place where there's an insurance company in the mix providing the coverage, this bill applies to.
Okay. Yeah, except most of Blue Cross, and we'll be hearing from them, is dealing with managing self-insured plans rather than providing the coverage. And in those cases, this bill will not affect them.
Yeah, and the other community that this bill will not affect are the individual policy purchasers. So if I, in my business, decided to go buy an individual policy, I'm not part of a group, the policies that I would be buying aren't subject to this bill either. So, okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Next, Rick Trelevin? Trelevin?
Here you go, the first time.
Trelevin. Mitch Anderson and Sonia Tanner? Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
I think it's Sonia's birthday today. Happy birthday, Sonia. All right. Rick, you'd like to start, perhaps?
Sure. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I'm Rick Trelevin. I'm president of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Providers Association of Oregon and executive director of Best Care Treatment Services in Central Oregon. I'm also the employer of 59 employees. The decisions I make will determine their health care coverage. And incidentally, I'm currently negotiating for the next year's plan, so this is very much in my mind. In the past 3 years, my agency has had the same carrier with the same benefits. We have seen increases of 14, 10, and 20% over the last 3 years. That amounts to a 44% increase over the last 3 years. We've certainly seen, as other employers have seen, double-digit increases for many, many years. As this implies, I did take a year of economics, I know basic economics at least a little bit, that we have a profoundly broken healthcare system that is on an unsustainable economic trajectory. As an employer, the one-time 1% increase that this proposal represents is a wash. Won't impact my decisions about health care coverage for my employees. And then finally, as just an impact, yesterday, unrelated to this bill, I was chatting with members of National Alliance for the Mentally Ill in Central Oregon, and they were talking about their calls that they get. And they don't get calls, the angry calls they were talking about. In the middle of the night, angry calls, and they're not from poor folks. They're from middle-class folks who are not able to access basic care for their children. That's my testimony. Thank you very much. I'll accept the question.
Commander, Rick, did you ask your carriers as a part of your trying to renegotiate your insurance to voluntarily completely cover mental health as a part of it? Did you say you're willing to pay for it and ask them to bid that as a part of your coverage?
I've had that as part of my coverage all along.
So it is in your coverage, huh?
Yes.
You know, I was confused about a statement you made, a one-time increase for mental health services. I didn't understand what you meant by a one-time increase.
The increase of around 1%, give or take a couple percentage points, that this represents would, my understanding, would tack on the 20% increase I'm facing today for this year might be 21%, but you would not have 1% additional every year.
That doesn't make any sense to me. The price of the coverage has increased, so you're paying more every year. So it's not one time.
Well, these
you might have one price increase.
I would have one price increase, and that price increase would be embedded. But the percentage increases I'm talking about are, so if I have a base amount, if I'm paying $100, it's actually $1,000, but $100 for my insurance. Right now, 3 years ago, now I'm paying $144 for that insurance. This would represent $145.
No, I understand what you're saying. My point was, it sounded to me like you were suggesting it's a one-time payment that you were going to make, but it's in fact a continuing payment. It'll be an increase, but you'll be paying a continued amount.
But it's not
indefinitely
increasing. Yes, exactly. But it's not increasing 1% each year.
Okay. All right. Other questions, Representative Greenland?
Yeah. Your premiums now is about $1,000 a month per employee. I just think I heard you say.
Between, yes.
Do you know what proportion of that is for? And you have complete parity in mental health and substance abuse treatment program. It's completely covered. Do you have any sense of what proportion of your premium is included in that?
I can't honestly tell you. It's a very small percentage. It's not a meaningful part of my negotiation. It's so small. It's not where the increases are happening.
The
increases are happening in medication.
Is the question?
Yeah, it's not even broken out.
It's the medication.
It's medications is what's. What my insurance carriers are telling me is driving the increases.
And you know what proportion of those are for mental health medications?
Again, it's from what they tell me, it's small, but I don't have the data.
Thank you, sir.
President Cameron?
Yeah, Rick, thank you for your testimony. I just want to make sure I'm clear. You already, as an employer, choose to have parity in your health plan. Is that what I'm understanding here?
Correct. As running a mental health and drug and alcohol nonprofit, I could not deal with the hypocrisy of not having that.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. So it would be possible to ask your insurance carrier to give you a price without that in there?
Yes, it would be possible. I could choose a different plan than what they give me.
To know what that is, but you don't know what that would be, what the price difference would be, because you've never asked for that, because you're just saying I want this and I don't even want to know what it would be without it. Is
well,
that correct?
What every year what I do is I sit down with my insurance carrier and we take a look at all the possible plans that are willing to bid, and I tell them what I'm looking for in those policies, and so that's what it presents to me.
Okay, so we don't know how much it would be without the parity in it.
What we do know from a great deal of research is that it represents about 1%, give or take a few percentage points.
Maybe.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Boone.
I just wondered what company it was. You can tell us.
Pacific Care.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Rick. Mitch.
Chair Dalto, members of the committee. My name's Mitchell Anderson. I'm the president of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs and the mental health director for Benton County. And I'm here to provide testimony in support of parity. You'll find my written testimony in the silver packet that you received. I'm in the middle of working with a number of families in our community to rebuild and strengthen our children's mental health system. And one of the things I've really been struck by is the countless stories I hear at every one of these meetings about how the private insurance system has failed family members trying to get care for their children. What I hear over and over again is that their benefits were so limited they couldn't get the services they needed. And what I want to emphasize is that who pays the cost of that? What I find is that families are trying to ration what limited benefit they have by not going to appointments, not getting all the services they need, and the family suffers for that. The child's problems get worse. The family has difficulty managing the child at home. Siblings suffer as problems occur within the household. So the family is very stressed. Then that child is in school. Classrooms that have 30-plus kids in them and a teacher who's trying hard, but there are children with emotional problems and they can't get the level of care that they need. And the school suffers. And all the rest of the children in those classrooms suffer for that. Ultimately, because these children are not able to get the proactive care they need, things reach a crisis point. The child may be kicked out of school and not get what they need. Because they come to county crisis programs, again funded by the state, who are covering now the cost of care because the insurance companies weren't there. Ultimately, the family may have the situation get so bad that the family looks at residential treatment, exhausts benefits very quickly. Parents are put in the position of giving up voluntary custody, and what happens is a cost shift to the state. The state is then picking up the cost of this care for this child and family. We recently did, our Commission on Children and Families did a study of our kids' mental health system in Benton County with the purpose of helping us redesign our system. And what our study said by the folks who are involved in it said, while Benton County seems to have a developing system of care for publicly funded youth, the system for privately insured children is sometimes described as a non-system or a system that is significantly broken. Without parity, we can't begin to build a system that works for all of our children. And when one of our children can't get the support they need, it affects all of our other children. Ultimately, it affects the state because the state may end up picking up the cost of care when insurance companies don't step up and cover it. So I again urge you to support parity. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. That intrigues me that the family loses control, loses custody of the child, goes over to the state, who is paying for the care then. Is that what you said?
Mm-hmm.
Why can't the family retain custody and the state pay? Can't we work out something that allows...
Well, I think if the family has jobs and insurance...
Right, but if they don't?
Getting Oregon Health Plan coverage is not necessarily an option unless the child is a family of one, which means a voluntary relinquishment of custody.
Yeah, thank you. You mentioned the children that are impacted by this legislation. How many children? Because we've heard discussion about all the policies that would not be covered under this legislation. Do we know, when we're talking about the numbers of children in the state of Oregon, how many would be impacted by the passage of this legislation?
Representative Dalto, Representative Cameron, I cannot give you an exact figure for that. I know it's substantial in Benton County because Benton County is fortunate to have a fairly high employment rate, and so many of the children in our community do have families with insurance, but I can't give you a number.
That'd be good information to have if somebody could provide that for us. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sonia.
I would like to thank the members of the committee for this opportunity to briefly share my thoughts with you.
As you get into it, can you introduce yourself?
Yes. Oh. My name is Sonia Tanner, and I have a terrific son named Nathan who happens to have Asperger's syndrome with psychotic and depressive features. Asperger's is similar to high-functioning autism. our lives have been very complicated by the fact that Oregon does not have mental health parity. When we had private insurance, it was virtually impossible to access all of the services we needed because of this. Instead, on two different occasions, I received letters from Kaiser Permanente stating that my son was going to run out of counseling visits if he kept attending counseling at his present rate. I have two of the letters here. One is for counseling and one is for inpatient, and in part they read, "Since his mental health benefit is limited, we feel it is important to keep you apprised of the amount he has used and the approximate benefit amount still available to him." And the other one reads in part, "This letter is being sent to advise you that your child has reached their maximum benefit for inpatient mental health services provided by Kaiser Permanente." So, on his second hospitalization, the hospital tried to discharge him early because he ran out of coverage. During this time, I also had problems with my employer because of my intense family needs. Ultimately, I found that the only way to really provide adequate mental health care was for him to be on the Oregon Health Plan, and he is now on disability. While he has been on OHP, we have been able to have adequate counseling, a skills trainer, a parenting coach, and case management, all when it was needed. Not having parity perpetuates the stigma of mental illness and is really just legal discrimination. If my son had almost any other disorder that wasn't considered a mental illness, he would have gotten the treatment that he needed. I would also like to add that not having parity in Oregon compounds the suffering of those with mental illness. Reducing our income enough to qualify for OHP and disability has meant that at times we have been on food stamps. Our phone has been shut off once and our gas has been shut off twice, once for a week. This is a choice I have been forced to make in order to have adequate mental health care for my child. Now that my son has received the services he needs, he is doing very well and needs pretty minimal care. I am thrilled, and our life is so much better. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you very much. Questions for Sonia? Okay, thanks very much to all of you. Vincent Salvi, is Vincent here?
Yes.
Okay, Vincent Salvi. Betsy Hansen? Is Betsy here? And this name I had trouble reading. Is it Kennard?
Kennard Adams.
Kennard Adams. We invite you forward, sir.
I want to thank you, Chair Dalto, and this committee for having us here today. My name is Betsy Hansen, and I am the one of the past executive directors of NAMI Washington County, so I'm very active with the NAMI organization. I'm also a retired nurse of 25-plus years, but most importantly, I am the mother and an aunt of two people in our family that have major mental illness. I've submitted a very brief, as I know the time limit, for you, but I think what I'll do, just so I stay on track, is just read it briefly for you. This is very specific to our parity issue that we had when our son came home from college. My husband, Jerry, by the way, could not be here today because of another commitment. However, he did help construct this testimony today. My husband, Jerry, and I, for the first time, needed mental health and addiction benefits in 2000 for our son home from college, ill at age 19. We assumed we had great mental medical benefits through Providence Good Health Care Plan, and that our son's treatment would be covered, or at least a good portion of it would be. We learned that our insurance coverage was only $3,500 in a 24-month period. Fortunately, we were able to refinance our home to pay the additional costs for mental and addiction services, just shy of $50,000, and that was for about the first 5 months of his home, $50,000. We were then forced to put our son on the Oregon Health Plan to get adequate coverage for mental health and addiction services. Again, we had to cancel our private insurance on our son due to the incredible lack of benefits it offered, and the Oregon Health Plan became the only viable option. My background as an RN tells me that adequate mental health and addiction insurance coverage would lead to early diagnosis and treatment more often. With early detection and adequate treatment, medication, and therapy, many people would likely move towards recovery quicker to lead more productive lives. We all realize that early detection of breast cancer, for instance, and colon cancer saves lives, and it's time to realize the same for our own mental health. Parity simply needs to happen, and in the end, it will save lives and taxpayer dollars. I appreciate your support of any of one of these three bills. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions or comments for Ms. Hanson? Okay, thanks. Good morning, welcome.
Thank you. I can understand you cannot read my writing, Chairman Delto. I'm a retired dentist.
Okay.
Likewise. I would like to speak.
Mr. Adams, could you introduce yourself for the record?
I'm Dr. Kennard Adams.
Thank you.
And I now currently live in the Capitol Manor in West Salem.
Thank you.
I do not intend to speak to this first issue, but I wish that you would consider, Chairman Delto, getting all insurance carriers covering mental health care coverage. Most of us, as small employers, do not think it's necessary to have mental health coverage. And it's not necessary till you have a loved one that the bombshells hit on. Okay. My grandson came home from the service, and in his particular case, he had beautiful mental health coverage because it was long enough ago that before they were tightening down the purse strings, would be my guess. But we took him up to the emergency room on a Saturday. He decided that was kind of a forced trip, but he voluntarily decided to stay. But at that point, he could not focus. You talk to him, his eye would be every which way, and he was quite psychotic. He was our first grandchild, a beautiful child, but in junior high school, things changed, and of course, with so many of these mental health illnesses, this is what happens. They don't come out of it. He ended up being diagnosed with as being bipolar and a methamphetamine addiction. And if he has one more dose of methamphetamine, he'll be permanently psychotic. Today, at this moment, he's been working through the Gulf Foundation for the state, and he's being interviewed for a permanent job, and I hope it goes well for him. And he's made significant recovery and is drug free. Granddaughter in the same family ends up with borderline personality. This is kind of a nondescript diagnosis in a way, except it does have its qualifications. Somewhat similar to bipolar and schizoid, except that really they are almost permanently depressed. And medications don't touch it. It was added to by the fact that she was raped when she was 10 by a 68-year-old former friend of mine in our church. And so her self-image has continued to go downhill. She has finally learned destructive behavior is through the counseling that she's getting through the Oregon Health Plan. And I said, well, what did that mean to you, Jessica? She said, well, when I married Ted. Well, yeah, Ted was a drug dealer in Portland, is now in federal prison. And the father of her two children. And she's learned that when she cuts her wrist, that's self-destructive behavior. She she finally got into this having to get help because she's trying to get her children back when they were taken away from her. I'm not quite sure where this story is going to end up. But these people do need parity, they need mental health coverage, and it needs to be equal throughout our state. Thank you, Chairman Dalton, and the rest of the committee.
Thank you, Dr. Adams, very much. And then Mr. Salvi.
Chairman Dalto and members of the committee, I submitted written testimony, so I'm just going to try and summarize it given the time constraints. I don't believe anybody else has yet submitted. I know many of my friends in the audience probably have copies of the mental health parity cost savings analysis that was done in the state of Washington, so I've actually given copies to you. I don't want to duplicate what others are doing, but I think it's critical because that study has incredible amount of data and multiple studies indicating that parity is cost effective. And I think more than anything else, I mean, I have a personal story to share, but what I believe in my heart is that nobody is opposed to providing health care for those who have need, that we all struggle and you're struggling with trying to find a means to pay for it and to balance whether that's appropriate. When I ask you to look at the analyses that are done in this packet, it's very closely aligned with what many of the governor's task force here in Oregon have found, but many of the studies are very new. And I think more than anything else, the issue today is different than it was 2 or 4 or 10 years ago with respect to whether parity is affordable. Study after study after study has shown that it is. And more than anything else, that the savings to employers, whether they be public employers or private employers, is enormous and way, way over offsets any actual out-of-pocket costs. In fact, if you think about what studies have shown for the tens of billions of dollars in lost productivity, disability, absenteeism, and translate that into the state of Oregon, the numbers are in the tens and tens of millions of dollars. Let me just share really, really briefly my story, because 5 years ago, my oldest son, Nick, came down with a very, very sudden and really literally overnight psychotic episode when we were on vacation in Central Oregon. And somewhat mirroring the gentleman from Central Oregon, we assumed we could take him to the hospital and get treatment. Well, not so much the issue on insurance coverage, but the hospital said, no, we don't treat. We don't have anybody who can treat. We have to go back to Portland. We went back to Portland, took him to St. Vincent's, where our pediatrician had recommended we take him, and lo and behold, St. Vincent said they could not treat our son. And so we began that very difficult journey through the healthcare system to try and find treatment for him. We were able to get him into the Emanuel Hospital. But to make a long story short, he had 3 hospitalizations over 3 months. We ran out of insurance on our 3rd hospitalization. We have, as I've learned, pretty good insurance through ODS, but it was only 21 days out of every 2 years. And the second day of that hospitalization in Providence, the business office called me and said, we need to talk. And I guaranteed payment, although I didn't have the funds available, but I guaranteed payment. At least I had a good job. My wife was working, and we felt that we could somehow find the funds. In fact, we ended up drawing down our retirement funds and taking out a second mortgage to pay what turned out to be a $24,000 bill. But we were willing to do that, and we had the means to do that. What I've learned over and over again in talking to people about this since then is that very few people really can make those type of financial commitments. But what it did, it allowed us to be there for our son. It allowed our family members to be there in Portland. It allowed the personal contact with the doctors and the caregivers that could help direct his care. And that made an enormous difference on setting him on a course toward ultimate recovery. He has now been diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder. He is on Social Security disability. He is also now on the Oregon Health Plan, but we've only recently gotten him on that. We made a monster commitment in those first 2 years after his diagnosis to keep him home and to pay the costs, which we no longer had through our health care coverage, but also to keep him out of the hospital. And I think the one thing I do want to encourage you so strongly is to look at the benefits overall, not the few dollars or $10 or whatever it may be per month, if you think about the studies that show it's roughly a 1% increase. And that's a real cost, and I acknowledge that. But think about the cost to employers. One of my coworkers, at the same time my son, was in the hospital, was also in the hospital for psychiatric care on the floor above him, and she was out of work for several months. I lost many, many days of work time, and my wife took off several months to stay home to try and take care of her son because we knew we couldn't have him in a hospital close to home. And that was a real cost to my employer and to my wife's employer. So I ask you to consider very carefully these studies that show the cost benefits, when you weigh them, are very, very tangible. As I told my son who was coming down today, he really encouraged me to encourage you to vote out this bill to the floor. I think it's very clear that there's huge bipartisan support for it. Republicans, Democrats see the need. You can't ignore this need. It, I think, has been shown to be effective. It has been in our family. Our son is still severely disabled, but he has recovered enormously from where he was 5 years ago. So I ask for your support.
What's your son's name?
My son's name is Nicholas, or Nick.
Okay, well, tell Nick you presented the message, and we appreciate it.
Thank you.
And how's that for personal service, Mr. Salvi? Yesterday you asked for a hearing, today you get it.
I want to thank you again,
Chair. It was timing.
Outstanding. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks very much. Friends, it's 11:30, and I'm going to make this executive decision. We're going to go until 11:40. We're going to recess this. Well, actually, we're going to go to 11:35. We will recess this meeting, and we will come back in at 2 o'clock. I will be here at 2 o'clock. If you can come, we encourage you to come back at 2 o'clock. That way, we will not shortchange anybody. That way, nobody has to feel rushed. That way, people can give their complete testimony and not have to rush. And I was
going to... material here.
Yeah, we can leave our material here. And I was also going to see if there's anybody in the audience that absolutely, absolutely cannot return at 2 o'clock that would like to come forward. And, okay, I see one, two. Let me see hands. Just raise them. Don't be shy. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay, we'll start with you, sir, ma'am. I'm sorry. At this way, I don't know your names, but you can just come forward.
Stay a couple of minutes.
The folks who cannot stay, can you please go to the desk and write your names down and your association down, or whoever you're here for, or yourself. That way I know who you are. Just on the table over there, please, the card table. Staff, the far table, please. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Chairman Delto. I'm Daniel Sosi. I'm a dentist here in town, just on the other side of the Bush Park. I live there, and my office is there. In my practice, I see patients that have mental health problems and patients with adult children that have debilitating mental health problems. Without medications and mental health services, these patients do not function and navigate through normal lives. Simple things like brushing and flossing do not happen. Moreover, making and showing up for dental appointments is very problematic. When these undertreated mental health patients have a dental crisis and show up at dental offices or emergency rooms across our community, the costs get really expensive really fast. One front tooth, unbrushed, untreated, can cost between $500 and $2,500 to replace. People have 32 teeth. My untreated mental health patients cannot afford dental treatment. Even extracting all of these patients' teeth would cost thousands of dollars. Diagnosing and treating mental health sounds expensive up front. However, under-treatment leads directly to enormous costs later for society. This sounds like a dental care story, doesn't it? It is like the issues we see in dental care, except in the mental health arena, there's no fluoridated water to help us. It's expensive to go to the dentist, but it's more expensive not to. This under-treated segment of our population that has mental health problems loses big time, and the rest of us have to pay much more for it. I hope that you see mental health care like I do. It's the upfront brushing and flossing that keeps us all out of bigger problems later. Mental health care parity will help keep Oregon out of much bigger problems later. Thanks for your time and your help on this important matter.
Thank you, Dr. Sosi, and your advocacy. Can I also invite Dr. Maggie Bennington-Davis forward, please, and invite you. Hello.
Hi. My name is Dawn Bonder, and I represent the Oregon Business Association. Thank you for allowing me to squeeze in this testimony today. I want to just take a moment and remind you that the Oregon Business Association is comprised of some of the state's major corporations, Nike, Columbia Sportswear, Standard Insurance, Wells Fargo, as well as over 250 member companies, some of them Oregon Homegrowns, Neil Kelly, Norm Thompson, Hannah Anderson. Our healthcare committee and our executive committee has overwhelmingly supported mental health parity, and we did it through the vehicle of SB 1 with the bill we were looking at. I submitted written testimony on behalf of the Oregon Business Association as well as one of our member companies, Hannah Anderson. So the two or three points I just want to really hit home for you to be brief is, one, the perceived cost. Our member companies recognize that there is going to be some increase in premiums. However, they also recognize that you really need to take a forward-looking view of the investment that those premiums make in terms of reducing costs in other ways, absenteeism, use of your physical health plan, and just productivity of workers, longevity of workers with the company. Those are valuable benefits that are sometimes really hard to quantify, and when compared with the ease of quantifying an increased premium, you lose sight of the potential benefits. And our member companies realize that those benefits are there. Also, our companies realize that you need to be competitive in your healthcare offerings, and none of them intend to drop health insurance coverage because of mental health parity. In fact, they welcome the opportunity to be able to offer these services to their employees in order to gain those benefits and to be competitive in the best way possible. They also are looking towards reducing the stigma of mental illness. They recognize that if there was not the stigma associated with it, many of their employees would step forward and get help and treatment much earlier on in the game, thereby really reducing the costliness and seriousness of the ailments that they tend to deal with later on. And from a big picture policy perspective, we recognize as an organization that we do pay for these mental health treatments. The public pays for it instead of the insurance companies. And if we're going to do anything about fixing our broken healthcare system, we really need to work on breaking down these silos and making sure that we have an actuarial system that functions. And by providing mental health parity, this is a step in the direction of seeing that that happens. So we overwhelmingly support this measure and really urge you to please pass this out of committee and put it on the floor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Cameron?
Yes, thank you. Don, thanks for your testimony today. I'm just curious on the, how many members do you have of the Oregon Business Association?
There's a, it changes daily, but it's about 250.
Okay, and how many of those members are self-insured?
I don't know. I'm sorry, I don't have that statistic. We do have a number, a good number of very small companies, and some of them may be self-insured. Some of them clearly are self-insured. I don't have a statistic for you. I can provide that.
You mean the larger companies, not the smaller companies?
Of the large companies, how many fall into the ERISA self-insured category? I don't have that statistic with me. I can provide it for you.
That would be good. And then I'd also like to know, of those already that are exempt from, that would be exempt from this law, how many of them already extend parity?
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Bennington-Davis.
Chair Dalto, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Dr. Maggie Bennington-Davis. I'm a psychiatrist, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Psychiatric Association. We urge support for mental health parity as represented by these three bills. Psychiatry is actually getting very good at diagnosing and treating the symptoms of mental illness. And even more exciting, we are getting closer to curing and preventing mental illness. A remaining major obstacle, though, is the continuing insurance discrimination that leads to lack of access by many Oregonians. So science has brought our medical understanding and treatment this far, but now Oregon is in a minority of states that's sort of stuck because we failed to secure all of the medically necessary care for mental illness, and that is due simply to open legal, albeit unethical, insurance discrimination in this state. Oregon can't afford to continue insurance discrimination because when untreated, symptoms of mental illness costs a lot, as you've already heard, and that cost shows up in suicides, the criminal justice system, poor school performance, family disruption, and complications of physical illnesses, and apparently in dental offices as well. You know, if someone without mental health insurance, parity in their insurance, has a heart attack, they can get treatment for their high cholesterol, they can get surgery on their arteries, but they don't get any treatment for the depression that almost inevitably accompanies a heart attack that is just as likely to disable them as their physical problems. The struggle for parity is a triumph, a struggle for the triumph of science over stigma. So on behalf of Oregon's physicians, the psychiatrists, the people that we serve, their families, we urge you to require simple equity in the treatment of mental illness. Please vote yes on these bills.
Okay, thank you very much. And the last three we'll hear, actually it looks like four, is there a Melanie and Brett Hamming? Okay, well, we'll wait for your husband to come back if you want. Chris Borneff? Is Monica? Oh, okay. Scott Manchester? The House is probably going to start voting on bills here pretty soon, and I don't like to miss votes, so we're going to hear from these folks, and then we'll come back. So, good morning and welcome. Thanks for being here. And go ahead and start, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Scott Manchester. I'm the executive director of the Oregon chapter of the National Association of Social Workers, which represents more than 1,700 professional social workers in Oregon. Social workers provide about 40% of mental health care in the nation and in Oregon. And this is, therefore, an extremely important issue for us. We are in favor of all of these bills. We believe there's a really, really great need for the legislation. Oregon is currently one of the few states that do not require significant group health insurance parity for mental illness and chemical dependency. We know there are concerns about the cost of care and the cost of insurance and the impact of this legislation on those costs. We would like to point out that a great deal of research indicates that there are cost savings when you provide adequate coverage for mental health. Any small addition to the cost of premium, we believe, will be much more than offset by savings in the cost of care and in additional productivity of workers. And there's also issues of fairness. The Surgeon General's 1999 report on mental health concluded that there is no scientific justification for treating mental health and physical health differently. And we believe that it is the current situation in Oregon where those illnesses are treated differently by most group health insurance plans is unfair, and that parity will rectify that unfairness. And we would also like to point out that the treatment of mental illness and chemical dependency is effective. And I think I'll stop there because I know time is short, and simply urge you to move this legislation onto the floor.
Thank you very much for your message. I have your testimony here, and the members will take a look at it when they return. Thank you. Good morning. Welcome. You're Chris Borneff?
Borneff. Yeah. My name is Chris Borneff. I'm with Trillium Family Services. We're a comprehensive provider of mental health services to children and family with locations in Corvallis, Portland, and Bend. Here to support the legislation of parity. I just wanted to quickly, with time constraints, share a quick story as to the odd paradox of treating children who have access to Oregon Health Plan versus children who have access to private insurance. The children, we overwhelmingly serve children who are on the Oregon Health Plan because they have the benefits available to receive the clinically necessary care that they need. And we are able to do this very effectively clinically, and we're also able to manage costs effectively, and our outcomes are excellent. When it comes to children who are served by private insurance, it's another story. Often private insurance, group insurance, is a trap that families fall into. It's as if insurance companies are pretending them pretending to offer them the help they need, but the benefits are so limited and the restrictions so strict on these families that they can't get the care for their children as clinically necessary. I share with you one case that a family we recently worked with, a young girl who was in grade school who had a case of ADHD, which is common for that age group. She was having difficulty performing in school, could not control her impulses, she was becoming more and more aggressive. What this child needed was she had a referral to come see a child psychiatrist, but her insurance company wouldn't cover it. The two psychiatrists that were on her plan that they would cover for were outside her region. This is a family that was employed. They did have access to private insurance, but they were on the margins. It wasn't something that they could take time off to go complete this. There was a qualified child psychiatrist available at our institution, but they couldn't see that person. Wasn't on couldn't receive insurance clearance to do that, and the family couldn't afford the out-of-pocket expense. The family also had only 12, limited to 12 outpatient visits per year. The child needed more intensive therapy. It needed family therapy, which was not covered. Only individual therapy was covered. The family would have benefited from an in-home therapist coming into the home and doing comprehensive family therapy. That was not covered also. So it was a matter of doing nothing, because you can't exhaust this family's benefits with treatment that will not help. Her condition advanced. It got worse. Her aggressiveness got worse. The school district put her in different environments that did not succeed, and her condition advanced to the point that finally she qualified for admission to residential care. And finally, our child's psychiatrist was able to do a complete assessment on her condition. And what it came down to was simply proper medication management. With the proper medication, the proper oversight, this child quickly improved. Had this been done at first, the cost to the insurance company would have been approximately, with parity, about $400. Just like you go see your family physician, a referral could have been made to an expert, in this case a child psychiatrist. Just as if you have an injury that requires you to go see an orthopedist or a cardiologist, under medical insurance that would have been no problem. It would have been low cost. In this case, the cost to the insurance company was more than 10 times the original cost, and simply for a simple case of medication management. And now today, this child has improved. We've been able to do the follow-up therapy that was necessary, and she's succeeding in her school environment, and the family is succeeding. And again, the equity between the medical side, if it's good for the medical side, it is good for the mental health side.
Okay. Thank you very much. And then it's Melanie?
Okay. Yes, thank you. My name is Melanie Hamming, and I am a state employee and a member of the union, and I have good medical benefits. One of the reasons I can't come back later today is I have a husband and a son who both have multiple brain disorders. They are on 6 medications each, need regular counseling, have not had hospitalization with psychotic breaks, basically, because we have been able to keep up with the medications. When Feb got the parity, it cost them 0.5% more for their insurance, and even so, it's an uphill battle. We have lots and lots of co-pays, and I run out of regularly sick and vacation leave. So I just wanted to let you know that it does work. It's still difficult. We're still fighting for lower health benefits, and I'm very hopeful. And my husband wanted to be here to support me, but because of his mental disorder, he's probably wandering around interested in other things that he's seen, that he does really want to say that he appreciates the benefits that we do have. Please keep them and make them better. Thank you.
I wander around quite a bit, too. Sometimes not sure where we're going. Well, tell your husband that we missed him, but hopefully we'll see him another time. So thank you very much. Apologize for rushing folks through, but we do have, you know, quite a bit of folks that are left on the list. Let me just read names that I have that I will take up later. Robert Lundblad, Kathleen Riss, Chris Anderson, Senator Ben Westland, Joanne, is it Alshin? Atchison, Marissa Elmquist, is it a Paul?
Yeah, but he's a Paul.
Patrick Pine, Pam Lally, John Powell, Elise Brown, And if I've not called your name, we're going to put another sign-up sheet over there to make sure that we go Robert Castagna.
Oh, okay.
And if anybody else wishes to testify whose name wasn't called, we'll make sure that there's a sign-up sheet on the right. There is one already. And there's a nice cafe outside, or you can walk around, have lunch. The house is in session. You're welcome to take a peek at what we do upstairs. And we'll see you back at 2 p.m. So with that, we stand in recess until 2 p.m.
Now,
we'll come back to order with the House Health and Human Services Committee this Friday, May 20th, 2005, picking up where we left off from this morning, continuing on the public hearings on House Bill 2913, House Bill 3444, Senate Bill 1, and House Joint Memorial 24. Excuse me. This morning we heard from various speakers from various different perspectives in support of these measures. So we had a couple of self-advocates, a couple of family advocates, and mental health professionals, and individuals providing testimony from the Public Employee Benefits Board and the Governor's Mental Health Task Force, and community programs. And so we are going to pick up from there, just kind of going along the list that I have. Is Kathleen Ritz here?
Okay.
Don't look like Kathleen.
Sure.
And then is Chris Anderson here?
Great.
And Senator, did you want to testify on this bill? Okay, we'll have you come next if you don't mind. So good afternoon, welcome.
Good afternoon, Senator, members of the committee. I'm obviously not Kathleen Riss. I'm John Holmes with NAMI of Multnomah County, Executive Director, representing 500 or so families from the Multnomah area that are affected by this legislation. And I'm here to submit testimony on behalf of Kathleen Riss, who was unable to attend. She is one of the families who, one of the family members who's affected by lack of parity in group plans here in Oregon, and is not able to have the leeway of giving up free time to come and testify, needing to save that time for when her child is in distress, and as a result of not having parity legislation in place, needing to save that sick time and for her child. So I have the written testimony here. Give that to the gentleman. And I can entertain questions as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chair, very much.
And committee members.
All right. And Chris Anderson.
Yes. Thank you, Chairman Balto and members of the committee. I'm Kristen Anderson from Salem. I'm the mother of a 9-year-old boy with bipolar disorder. Currently, mental illness on my insurance plan is treated differently from other physical illnesses. Care is limited and copays are higher, and I've had to beg for extended coverage. Sometimes I get a yes, but more often I've been told, no, we cannot justify extending benefits further. And I don't understand why this difference is allowed to continue. We know the brain is an organ of the body. We know that there are biochemical, physiological, and neurological causes for mental illness. And we know that mental illness can be treated. My son, it has been determined that he has a high potential for killing himself and or others. He needs continued treatment and support, and without treatment, he has more than a 50% chance of attempting suicide. All I'm asking is that all illnesses be treated the same. Limits and care should be the same for all illnesses. The parent of a child with leukemia would not be told, your insurance benefits have run out, the state can help you and your child, only if you release custody of your child to the state. In Oregon, that is what some parents of children with mental illnesses are told. Last week, I became one of them. All nurses and doctors must demonstrate knowledge in the area of mental illness. Medical providers are aware that considering the whole body is essential for complete health care. Brain disorders that visibly affect the body are treated as physical illnesses by insurance companies. This includes illnesses such as cerebral palsy and epilepsy. All brain disorders need to be treated the same as these brain disorders. Health insurance should be insurance for the whole body, which includes the brain. I implore you, please require insurance companies to treat my son's chronic, life-threatening illness like any other illness. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Greenlee.
How are you doing?
Okay.
It's hard, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
You said that this week you've been forced to give up custody of your child to the state.
No. Last week it was suggested that that may be what I'm going to need to do.
I see. I think we had another witness. We did. Did they say what would happen then? Would you become a foster home for your child?
Probably not. He'd have to probably live in a foster home. I'd have visitation. It would be a temporary custody agreement, but it would have to actually give up custody of him so he could access community services. Right now he's in residential and OHP is covering that, but I'm looking at getting him discharged and for supports in the community. I have some coverage left on my insurance. It'll probably cover, probably not the summer, you know, 2 months worth of the services that he needs. And I said after that, the only way that I'll probably be able to get supported services for him in the community is if he's not in my custody.
Is there somebody?
We may want to talk about that in the other subcommittee.
Sure, sure. And is there somebody in the audience maybe that wanted to have a different perspective? I saw some machinations back there, but maybe you'd have to come forward if you wanted to.
It's an interesting issue.
Yeah. You might have some different information you want.
Well, additional. My name's Linda Riley. I'm from Portland. And I haven't had a chance to talk to this lady, but I'm going to. I do know when she talked further, she probably is facing that exactly. In 1993, there was a bill passed that prohibited the child welfare from requiring parents to give up custody of their children for them to get out of home care. That is, for any disability, including emotional disorders, developmental disabilities, mental disorders. That was HB 3577. But if what she's talking about is she's wanting to keep him in the community, that's a different thing. I can understand. So if, for instance, if he was going to have residential care or long-term out-of-home care in a mental health group home, something like that, she could sign a child placement agreement where she'd keep legal custody, but the state would then take care of the physical custody. But what you need is to have the child in the least restrictive situation. So I understand exactly what she's saying. So I'm sorry if my head nodding is premature.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay. Senator Morris Anderson. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Our favorite nurse.
Yes. Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee. I wanted to come just to let you know that the Senate had spent a lot of time on this, too. And as the nurse of the legislature, I feel it's one of the most important bills this legislative session. I'm so happy that you are hearing it, Chairman. And as the previous woman did state, basically, we are not treating mental illness the same as we do physical illness. And we don't do this for diabetes. We don't do this for high blood pressure. Why should we have this discrimination with mental illness? And this legislation, it really makes a statement. It really is saying, no more. Mental illness is not a stigma. There should no longer be discrimination. And it really should be treated just like any other physical ailment. They really are real, treatable brain diseases. Our brain, the organ of the mind, deserves the same civil rights as much as any other body organ, like the heart or the lungs. The diagnoses and treatment options for mental illness have really never been better. They are wonderful. We're still making great inroads. We understand how the brain works. We understand the mental disorders, how mental disorders affect the brain better today than at any other time in history. Gone are the days when a disturbed person was put into the state psychiatric hospital to basically rot away. What a waste of so many lives in the past. People with mental disorders are really being set free today to become wonderful members of our society. Our ability to effectively treat mental illness has never been stronger. Yet, all this good news is for naught because there is open and legal insurance discrimination. A mentally ill person has the same right to medical care and coverage as a person with diabetes or high blood pressure or cancer treatments. What if we had said, sorry, you have had your 6 cancer treatments for the year, no more treatments. This is not right. We don't do it for cancer. We shouldn't be doing it for mental illness. It really is immoral to single out mentally ill persons and say, sorry, you can't be treated anymore. We really can't, I feel, accept health insurance discrimination against brain illnesses. A person born with bipolar, also known as manic depressive disorder, should be able to have access to medical coverage the same as a person born with diabetes. When mental disorders are untreated, the costs really are enormous. And that cost shows up in suicide, it shows up in criminal behavior, it shows up in poor school performance, family disruption, and chaos. Mental illness puts a terrible toll on our economy and on our patients, as well as what happens in the family. How many of us know individuals who have committed suicide due to mental illness? Senator Gordon Smith's son. How about Graham Clark, who was a city planner up in Portland, who cared so much about protecting the environment and keeping the city livable? He was a 41-year-old senior land use planner for the city of Portland who killed himself last week, or actually it was a month or so ago. And it's how sad, how tragic, and it's such a great loss. With the passage of this bill, we will start the healing, eliminate the stigma, and free the lives of so many special individuals. You've heard that premiums will go up, small businesses will drop coverage, but there are some facts that I think that are important to know. At McDonnell Douglas, absenteeism dropped 44% for employees treated with substance abuse issues. And when the Kennecott Copper Corporation provided mental health counseling for employees, its hospital, medical, and surgical costs decreased 48.9%. Health plans with the highest financial barriers to mental health services have higher rates of psychiatric long-term disability claims, and companies with easier access to mental health services see a reduced instance of long-term disability claims. So Oregon, I'll conclude, Oregon really lags behind 35 other states that have passed laws requiring mental and physical illnesses receive similar treatment from health insurers. And I sure would like to, I know you're having a public hearing, but I sure would like to see you move the bill. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you very much, Senator Monica Anderson, Representative Greenland.
Thanks. Thanks, Senator Monica Anderson. You had a busy day today on the health care side. You heard this in your committee, did you not?
Yes.
We were distributed this report from the Washington Coalition for Insurance Coverage, and I don't know whether you saw it, but a compilation of a bunch of studies on the effect of introducing parity under the statement that introducing parity doesn't cost very much. But as I go through the study, this paper, page after page, what I find in there are statements that when you introduce managed behavioral care and parity at the same time, it mediates the cost of the increase in volume that comes about because of parity. And I think virtually every study here is talking about managed behavioral care and parity. We've managed in this state to, for example, take mental health drugs out of managing drug formularies. And there isn't anything in SB 1 that talks about this issue. It's basically we'll do parity and then we'll let the market figure out how to manage it.
Our mental health system needs a lot of work. And we are finding that when we closed Damish Hospital and we have placed over 800 people into the community for a number of reasons, and they're thriving very well, actually, and the community hasn't been responding as negatively as many people thought they would. We still have some issues with placing our patients from the Oregon State Hospital, but we're working on those issues. But no, those are things that I think we as a system are doing, and I think that with time, at least the State Oregon Mental Health Program is making changes, and I'm feeling cautiously optimistic that those managed care programs that we have, especially at the community level, are going to be much better than they are today.
If I may comment, but in this bill, we're implementing something on private health insurance, and we're saying you have to provide benefits, but we're not necessarily giving simultaneous. I mean, we're saying do it the same as any other thing, and a lot of those benefits are coming out of managed mental health and other things. I mean, wouldn't it make some sense to try and provide some incentives or some language about giving the health insurance plans the ability to manage services, in fact, the way they might manage other services? Or is that just implicit, do you think, in there?
I think we need to have the health insurance at the table a little bit for this. This was primarily directed toward, it's easier just to direct our efforts toward the insurance carriers at this point in time than the whole system.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson, did you have a comment?
Oh, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Senator.
Right. Is Joanne Alshin with the Salem NAMI Group here? She's not here. Okay. Linda Adams? Linda Adams here? No. Phil Chadsey? Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chairman Dalto and members of the committee. I'm Phil Chadsey. I'm the chairman of the NAMI Legislative and Public Policy Committee. I want to start off by talking about people who have parity at the present time. First of all, we have parity under ERISA for those who are self-insured under the Domenici Wellstone or Goldfine. I've forgotten which senator it is, but Senator Domenici is the senator from New Mexico that is the leading force in parity at the national level. He has a daughter that has a severe mental illness, and he's the one also that got President Bush to support parity in April 2002, although when the president was governor of Texas passed the parity bill. So parity has been in fact in Texas now for, well, 6-7 years. So first of all, we have the major employers under ERISA have parity. We have the state federal employees have parity. Since 2003, we have the state employees now have parity. And we have the results for the first year of that parity, which increased the cost less than 0.5%. And we'll know very shortly what the effect is for the second year. It's a 2-year contract period.
When will we know? When will we
know? I think it's in late June, early July. So it'll probably hopefully be after this session is over. But whatever it is, it's not going to be very much. In fact, my understanding is when the state has two insurance carriers for state employees, they have Regents Blue Cross, which contracted a 1% increase in the premium and then said that we'll readjust it at the end of the year. So they readjusted at the end of the first year and gave the state employees benefit board a refund for that first year since it was less than 1%. The other employer is Kaiser, and my understanding is that Kaiser didn't increase their premiums at all. They just granted parity as a part of the benefit package. So,
I mean, we should note that at the time the so-called parity was induced, they both had very rich mental health benefits and subsidies benefits already.
Well, all I'm saying is, my understanding is that they did not increase their.
But there's a difference between introducing parity from virtually no coverage to parity and parity when you have very rich benefits to begin with. I do think you want to note that.
Yeah. We had testimony this morning that somebody was paying $1,000 a month for insurance coverage. I had Regents Blue Cross when I was practicing law up until the end of last year through Regents, and I was paying $860 a month. And if you look at that and you say, all right, I pay $860 a month for parity or for insurance, and what do I get as far as mental health coverage? Well, what you get for that at the present time is about $13,000 in coverage every 2 years, which isn't a very good deal if you think about it. What you have insurance for is to cover against catastrophic losses. If you insured your house, if you say you own a $500,000 house, and you pay $1,000 a month insurance, which you wouldn't pay that much, but if you did, and suddenly we're told you have a fire and the house burns down, but you only get $12,000, you wouldn't think that was a very good deal. That's what we're faced with insurance for mental health. It's not a very good deal at the present time. You pay a lot for coverage, and these are very serious illnesses. If you look at the 1999 Surgeon General's report, major depression is the number one cause of disability in the United States. Manic depressive disorder, bipolar disorder, and schizophrenia are also in the top 10. So these are very serious illnesses that need full coverage. And a family faced with, and they nearly always occur, manifest themselves in late teenage, early 20s. And that's when you're usually on your parents' health care coverage. And if you get that and you have a child that has to be hospitalized, it doesn't take very long to run through $12,000, $13,000 worth of coverage. And then the family's paying for it. Then you're faced with the situation of mortgaging your house again, dipping into your other children's college funds, doing all kinds of things in order to pay for that additional coverage. And what eventually ends up, for most people, they don't have that resource. So then they go to the one policy that has full parity in Oregon for everybody. But in order to be there, you have to be poor. And that's the Oregon Health Plan. So if you're on the Oregon Health Plan, you have full parity. But the middle class doesn't have full parity if you're insured under any of the policies. I'm surprised somebody said this morning they could get coverage under, I think, Pacific Care. My law firm had coverage under Regents Blue Cross and Kaiser. We offered both of those. And I once asked our administrator whether or not we could get coverage, and she told me we couldn't get coverage. So that was news to me that somebody in the state of Oregon provides that kind of coverage. I'd be delighted to answer any questions you might have about parity.
Representative Greenlink.
Are you formally representing NAMI here?
Yes.
Uh-huh. NAMI's been pretty consistently opposed to managing drug costs for mental health drugs, both under the Oregon Health Plan and other places. Yet every report I look at in the book that was passed out today talks about managing mental health services, managing behavioral services. Would NAMI feel okay about linking parity with somehow the ability of the carriers to provide managed behavioral health care?
Well, first of all, if it's a formulary, I think we're opposed to it. Here's why we're opposed to particularly the antipsychotics.
Even though there's a formulary for other drugs, you're okay with the formulary for other drugs, but you don't want to manage mental health drugs on a parity basis with other drug coverage?
Let me say this. When you deal with the antipsychotics, you have the typical antipsychotics, the old ones, like Haldol, et cetera, which have tremendous side effects. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants those kind of things. You have the newer antipsychotics, starting with the ones, Clozaril, which is kind of the gold standard. It's the only one, I think, that's of the newer ones that's off patent. And it just came off patent.
I understand exactly what you're saying, but you're talking about parity. Does parity mean to treat mental health the same as other disorders?
Well, all I'm saying is that NAMI in the past has opposed a formulary for the simple reason that the atypical antipsychotics are not interchangeable. One what may work very well with one person and may not work at all with another person. My son has schizophrenia.
I understand the antipsychotic drug.
Yeah.
I understand that perfectly well.
Yeah.
We're talking about now policy issues here.
Okay.
I'm wondering whether NAMI is here to say across the board mental health treatment should be treated like every other disease, or is it only in certain circumstances that you want parity, and other circumstances you want special?
It should be treated like every other disease, but I'm just saying that, and I think the state has agreed with us, that a formulary is not the appropriate thing for antipsychotics.
The state does not agree with you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I'm actually the government relations representative for NAMI, and I think, Representative Greenlee, you asked a very good question about the hypocrisy of wanting parity on some things and not on others, and I know that it is sometimes perceived that way, that we want the same insurance, but we don't want the same guidelines as far as drug prescriptions. And actually, we've come to this legislative session supporting the idea of not being able to just randomly have a pharmacist replace your drugs, but to allow your doctor to do so and manage it should they choose to under your health plan. We have been supporting not a total whatever drug we want. We've been supporting this session the concept that it's just dispensed as written. So if your doctor insists on it, then your insurance should cover it. But if your doctor says the generic is okay, then we'll do that too.
But if I may continue. My question is, I've just noted, you passed this report out, I think, somebody did this morning. And I've just gotten about half of it, but all these yellow tags, are the citations in here about how parity costs 1%. Virtually every single one of them says parity costs 1% if it's introduced with a managed behavioral health treatment. So I'm interested, and the other one to talk to, when we're looking at this bill, would you not have any objection to language that said when parity is offered, it's okay for the carrier to introduce typical managed care techniques that they use for other illnesses, so that they can use formularies, they can use other algorithms, they can use the ability to manage care, because that's where the 1 or 2% argument comes from. It comes from managed care.
Well, I think
will you back that if we work on it in this committee and come up with some language like that, or will you be fighting it on that basis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, I hope it's okay if I answer. I think you were actually looking to Mr. Chadji's answer, but I'm hoping that I can. If you look at page 4 of Senate Bill 1, Section 8. It says nothing in this section prohibits a group health insurer from managing the provision of benefits through common methods, including but not limited to selectively contracted panels, health plan benefit and differential designs, pre-admission screening, prior authorization of services, utilization review, or other mechanisms designed to limit eligible expenses to those described in Section 3 of this section.
And you feel okay with that?
I'm okay with that. And Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlee, if you want further clarification of that, that includes the drug benefit, I think that as long as we're sure that we're consulting with the doctors and not overriding doctors' orders.
Well, that's sometimes a problem with diabetes. It's sometimes a problem with other illnesses.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, I think that in most cases, coming to you today, speaking on behalf of the mentally ill, where in the past I've worked for health insurance companies, I think in most cases if a doctor or a group of doctors feel strongly about one drug or another, the insurance companies reconcile that with their managed care. So we are perfectly happy to let those who can do and figure out the best way to provide the best care for the mentally ill at the same price.
We could add an amendment to this that would take away the mental health exclusion for formularies in the Oregon Health Plan as a part of this bill, and that wouldn't cause you any trouble?
Mr. Chair, I'm actually not at liberty to say that. However, I would tell you from my own personal experience working with the Oregon Health Plan that the formulary there wouldn't work well with the same mental capacities. You'd have to change the formulary.
President Greenlee, maybe we can allow them to think about it. Yeah, and
thank you
and
very
decide.
Much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you for letting me interrupt.
Yes.
And, you didn't interrupt. You helped very much.
Thank you.
Right. Okay. I think that pretty much concludes this call.
Unless you want to.
And sorry, I do need to tell you to start off. I support this legislation. I want you to understand that.
Linda Adams didn't show up, did she? No? Okay. All right, Lisa Trussell and Patrick Pine, please.
Sure, Dalto. Here's a chance to get back at Representative Kidd. Yeah, for the evil treatment you give him on elections and rules. Oh, it's terrible. You need to be there. You need to be there to see it.
All right. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lisa Trussell with AOI, and here today to oppose the parity bills. But I want to explain why. I don't want it to be perceived that AOI and our members aren't concerned about the issues that have been raised with this committee this morning. But what we're seeing is that insurance costs are rising. And there was discussion about the PEB experience being less than half a percent increase. And as it was pointed out previously, they started with a higher base than most of my members have. And so I think that if you're looking at what the impact might be on the small group market, it's closer to 2 to 2.5% increase. And that doesn't sound like a lot. That doesn't sound like a lot at all. But the data that we have, and it's from the last session, shows us that a 1% increase in Oregon means that 3,000 Oregonians lose their health insurance. And we see a growing number of people losing health insurance. So, you know, it looks like we're kind of focusing on designing the perfect health plan, and there's other mandate bills that are in the process right now. And my concern is that as we design the perfect plan, let's have it be a plan that people can actually afford. Because if you design a perfect plan and people can't afford it anymore, what have you done? And I put in my testimony in front of you some cost factors that I got off of the DCBS website, and you may have seen these numbers previously, but in the small group market, which most employers are in, the PPO plans run from a low of $817 a month, that's for family coverage, and those plans can be found in Marion and Polk counties, to a high of over $2,000 a month. And those high plans are in Clackamas, Multnomah, Washington, and Yamhill counties. And in the small group market, it is very common for the employer to pay the employee-only portion of the premium. So, and then if the employee wants to cover their dependents, they pay the difference. So if you look at what Marion County's family rate is, the difference to the employee to cover his family is $555 a month. And that's not every plan. This is a high that I pulled, a low I pulled off of the DCBS website. In the Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington Yamhill counties, what the difference is between the employee-only rate and the employee plus family, that's nearly $1,400. So what it means is that we're getting to the point. I'm not going to sit here today and tell you that a 2 to 2.5% increase on the employee benefit my members can't absorb. I'm not, you know, at some point you get to the straw that breaks the camel's back. What we're concerned about is that, say that we could cover the employee. We're not sure the employee can cover the increase any longer on their dependent coverage, and that's a concern. And there are other options besides the parity design. We have an existing benefit structure that hasn't been adjusted in several sessions that could be adjusted to raise the current limits on mental health. That's one idea. Another idea is that if parity truly is the most important coverage that we have, then take a look at the other 25 mandates that Oregon has passed and repeal some of them to equate to the cost of passing parity so that you don't have an increase. It's revenue neutral, if that's the right term. Probably not revenue, but neutral. The other thing, and then I'm going to have one of my members who's very knowledgeable about employee health benefit plans and has multi-state operations talk, but what I think is that if parity bill passes, what I think will happen is that larger employers who are on the fence with self-insuring will self-insure. And the reason is, under the ERISA exemption, they're not required to have the mental health benefits. And they can select on any of the benefits, actually, on any of the mandates, what they want to cover. So I think larger companies will go self-insured. And what I'm concerned about is that smaller companies will continue to have to do more benefit design changes, cost shift more over to the employees, or stop purchasing it altogether. And so, you know, we would ask that you reject the proposals before you today as they are and maybe consider some other options. And I'd be happy to answer any questions now or after Mr. Pine testifies.
Jim Cameron?
Yeah, you referred to some of the, I don't remember the number of mandates, but could you give examples of, you said to consider something else. What would be some of the examples of those mandates that you would suggest that maybe repeal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, I don't have the 25 with me, but you've received them before from the insurance division, and I'd be happy to give them to you. There's pregnancies covered. There's a variety of different things that we require coverage on. And there's other bills adding to those that are being considered. But within that list of 25, oh, it's just arrived. you have some chemical alcohol dependency, pregnancies. Some I can't even say. Maxillofacial prosthesis, inborn errors in metabolism, reimbursement, mammograms, pelvic exams, that sort of thing. And the list is 2 pages long, but you could kind of see where you can come up with maybe 2% savings and take a look at repealing those when you pass something like this.
Thanks.
On that same subject, could you talk a little bit about your thoughts about some of those mandates that are there and the fact that most of them are prevention-oriented things to a little bit up front will save a lot in the end game?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Boone, you know, I think that ideally that's true, but I'm not sure practically it is. And the reason is that with some of the things that we look at, they are for conditions that you end up charging an entire community a rate for conditions that they may never have. So, you know, I certainly don't know, even on self-insured employers, and that's kind of probably a place to look, is what are self-insured employers covering or not covering, because they're not subject to the mandates. But, for example, they typically will cover pregnancy. I don't know of any self-insured employer that doesn't cover pregnancy, so that's one you'd keep in. But I think you'd have to probably get a group together and talk about which ones could equal the amount of the cost increase that Senate Bill 1 or any other parity bill would, and what can be agreed upon to take out. But I don't have a suggested list of which ones would. I could go back and do that, but I think it would be more valuable if it was other people as a group working on which ones should come out.
One more comment, and I'm glad that you're here, Lisa. Thank you for the business viewpoint, basically. I guess I have concerns about how, as a small business person, we are so small, we don't have health insurance because we can't afford it. And what we do is we pay for our employees to go to the doctor, basically out of pocket. And so, but if we could afford it, what we would look for would be something that would provide good basic health coverage and, you know, a checkup up front saves it in the end, and that says finding something first rather than letting it get to full-blown whatever and then trying to pick up the cost there. And that's, and everybody's looking at this is physical. Well, mental health is the same thing, because you have this big domino effect that if you have someone with mental health issues, then they can't, maybe they could be treated and managed with medication. And if they don't get their medication, can't get to the doctor, get the medication, then all these things can come out at work. They eventually lose their job, which means they have no income. They may lose their home. Their family falls apart. Whatever happens, and then the cost eventually gets thrown onto the community in a much larger fashion and amount.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, I think some of that will be addressed in Mr. Pine's testimony, but at some point, you have to look at everything. And one of the examples for what benefits to take out might be to look at the Rocky Kings plan on the alternative health plan, what they eliminated as a start. You know, and it is a policy decision because the more you increase the cost, people fall off of the coverage base. So it's not a decision that I think is an easy one for you to make. But you, as policymakers, that's what you're balancing, is the increase and the knowing that you're going to have people that are now going to become uninsured worth the addition of the benefit for those who are fortunate enough to continue their coverage.
Thank you.
I thought we heard testimony earlier that there was a federal bill that required parity under ERISA. Is that the
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenland, I heard that too, but there are carriers that are in here, and I'm not sure if they're signed up to testify or not, so I'd ask them. But as far as I know, and Mr. Pine may have more knowledge on this than I, the mandates don't apply. The Oregon mandates don't apply if you're covered under a self-insured because of the ERISA exemptions.
We need to hear more about that. We may want to hear more about that.
Okay, Mr. Pine.
Thank you, Chair Dalto, members of the committee. I'm Patrick Pine. I'm Corporate Benefits Manager for ESCO Corporation. Work out of the headquarters in Portland. I also serve as the Chair of AOI's Health Policy Advisory Committee.
Can you remind me what ESCO does?
ESCO is a large global steel parts manufacturer, primarily serving industrial applications.
In House District 33, and I'd be happy to get you to join with Steve Pratt, the CEO, and take a tour of it. You find it very interesting.
Yes, Representative Greenock recently toured our facilities, and any of you are interested, it is a fascinating tour. I've worked there for several years, and I'm always fascinated walking through our plant. A quick background might be in order, and I think I was here this morning, and I might be able to provide some answers to some of the questions that various committee members raised this morning. And I also want to mention this. Some of my comments are in the perspective of an Oregon-based employer, but we have operations in multiple states. We employ approximately 700 persons presently in our Portland-based facilities. We have about 400 people in numerous locations throughout California, which has another form of mental health parity and has had that for a few years. We have over 200 employees in Mississippi. We have over 100 employees in Kentucky, another 100 plus in Arizona. And then we have smaller numbers of employees in several other states. We provide a variety of medical and dental plans to these employees in each location using different combinations of plans and providers. We're currently fully insured for most of our folks, with the exception of a couple divisions, which I won't go into. But in the recent past, we have provided benefits in some self-insured forms. As a result of those multi-state operations, we do deal with a variety of different mandates state by state. In California, we have a form of mental health parity, which has been in existence since 99. It's similar but not identical to the proposal in Senate Bill 1. But in Colorado, for instance, we do not have this mandate, but we have a mandate in Colorado just as one example, that we must provide durable medical equipment for diabetics. That's a mandate we have in no other state. There are numerous other examples. In Oregon, we currently provide three options to our employees for medical insurance, a plan through what is known as a multi-employer trust, a plan through Pacific Air, and a plan through Kaiser Permanente. Currently, about 60% of our employees elect the multi-employer trust option because it is the lowest cost relative to the other options. About 35% elect Kaiser, and a relatively small number elect the Pacific Air option because it happens to be the most costly from the employee's perspective. The multi-employer trust plan is an indemnity-type plan, but it is a large multi-employer group, which is essentially self-insured, so therefore it's not subject to, or it, you have an ERISA-type preemption. They're not subject to anything that Senate Bill 1 would mandate. That board of that plan, which is composed of executives of the member companies that use that trust, have on numerous occasions over the years looked at providing some form of mental health benefits, such as are envisioned in Senate Bill 1, and they have consistently decided not to, mainly for cost reasons. They've had independent actuarial studies, and they've concluded that they did not want to add the additional cost burden, and they have not added benefits such as are envisioned in Senate Bill 1 for that reason. So roughly 60% of our employees, even if Senate Bill 1 were passed, would not feel the impact of Senate Bill 1's additional benefits by virtue of being in that plan. So a minority of our employees in Portland would feel the effects of Senate Bill 1 were it passed in the form that's before you. On the other hand, for the roughly third or so that are working and currently enrolled under a Kaiser-type plan, they would see some additional benefits, but I think it's already been mentioned, the Kaiser plan we offer does have a number of benefits already inherent in the plan, so you're not starting from a baseline of zero, if you will, to the proposed benefits in Senate Bill 1. So it's a little bit different depending on which plan and which employees I'm looking at. So there would be some impact on those employees choosing Kaiser. The reason I wanted to discuss that is, as I think Representative Cameron might ask this morning, about how many people are in self-insured plans. I looked at a state insurance commissioner report from about a year and a half ago, and I believe at the time it suggested that approximately a little over half of all the group plans in Oregon at the time were self-insured forms. A little, just a below a half were commercially insured at the time. That's from my recollection. So roughly speaking, you're probably looking at 50-50 in the group marketplace. But that was probably a year and a half ago. I suspect the self-insured might have risen a little bit, but that's speculative on my part.
Something like a million people.
So my point is even if Senate Bill 1 were to pass, it would affect a minority of the population in the state were it to be in effect in terms of the benefits that would be extended to people. It would not affect a majority of the population. I agree with Lisa. I think the other employers that I talk to, and particularly the smaller employers, this would be another reason for people to more seriously consider self-insurance if they are not presently self-insured. And of those who are presently self-insured, most, like the trust plan that we're a member of, I would say under present market conditions are unlikely to add these benefits, even if they could, because you could voluntarily provide some of these benefits on a self-insured model if you're an employer that felt that way. You could construct something. It's not simple, but it could be done without a state legislation. If I was an employer and I felt strongly enough, I could fashion a way to provide those benefits to my employees. I'm concerned, though, I think, is to follow up on what Lisa mentioned. For every small percentage increment increase, we are seeing not our employees dropping out of coverage, because we have a mandatory enrollment rule in Oregon, which is a condition of our membership in our trust. Our multi-employer trust requires all of our employees to be enrolled in a company-sponsored plan. They do not mandate to their dependents to be enrolled, and what we've seen is some erosion of our employees who are dropping coverage on their dependents, and I think you'll see that throughout the state, that's a common thing that's been going on, and not just in Oregon, but across the country. So there's a concern about people who cannot afford to cover their entire families, and maybe they cover themselves, but they're dropping it on their children or their spouses. And there's definitely, that's a serious, serious concern. We are concerned that Senate Bill 1 might exacerbate that issue. Now, I did want to talk about cost. There's been a lot of discussion about cost. Because we've been in California for some years, we have some experience based on our coverage in California. The California model, the first year after it was implemented, we experienced between a 5 and a 6% premium increase on the plans we had at that time, one of which was a Kaiser plan in both Northern and Southern California. That form of parity, the first year, we saw an increase to which the insurance underwriting analysts attributed about 5 to 6% increased first year out. That's not identical to Senate Bill 1, but that gives you a frame of reference. In the ensuing years, we've seen attributed approximately a 2 to 5% increase depending on the group, the plan, and a variety of factors. Presently, for the annual incremental cost of parity in California, my best guess based on a lot of research is it's probably affecting our premiums by around 2% additional per year. My best guess is on one other issue I want to comment on. A lot of the proponents have suggested that with parity there should be a resulting improved productivity because your employees will have better treatment for themselves and their family. There's a difficulty in corroborating that assertion. We did look in our California workforce at attendance rates, use of sick leave, and we frankly cannot find any different pattern from pre-California parity to today. If you look at the attendance rates, they're pretty much the same as they were in 99 to today on a per-employee basis. So while logically a lot of people would assert that theoretically, yeah, people should be more productive, it's a very difficult case to prove based on experience from our own analysis of our own workforce. I've talked to other employers who have had similar experiences. Now, not all. You've heard testimony earlier that some companies have experienced some substantial decreases in their other costs. I cannot say that's been our experience today. Finally, I wanted to talk about the dilemma that employers face. I think Lisa already mentioned, this is not an easy thing for us, and I think everybody who has the responsibility to provide for their employees feels very strongly about this. On a personal note, I want to tell you one story because I think it addresses a lot of the concerns. I happen to have two nephews, both of whom have conditions that might be described as behavioral disorders. Two different families. One family, one of my nephews, the parents, happen to be employed by an employer who has a self-insured type of coverage. There are no benefits for my nephew. His care has been provided by the family out of pocket, so to speak. I'm painfully aware of the consequences of that for our family, for my nephew. So I can assure you we understand how difficult this is, and I understand it firsthand. However, I have another nephew from another set of parents in my family. In that case, the parents happen to be employed with an employer who has a commercially insured plan, which has some of the benefits that are envisioned in Senate Bill 1. It has a higher level of behavioral health kinds of benefits in it. So they've had substantial additional financial assistance in treating my other nephew. If I was to step back a little bit, it's hard for me as a citizen to say, why does one of my nephews have a lot more financial assistance than another? But then I have to conclude that there's nothing in Senate Bill 1 that's going to change that. Even if Senate Bill 1 were passed, I would still have one nephew who would have substantial assistance through the form of insurance that by coincidence his parents happen to have. The other nephew will still be in the same position where the parents would not have a plan that would have the benefits envisioned in Senate Bill 1. That's to sort of say that's where I have some trouble with the proponent's argument about equity or discrimination. I don't really think that's what's happening here. I think those kinds of issues will remain with or without Senate Bill 1. That's a difficult thing to say. I hope the proponents don't take that as adversely or disrespectfully. But from first-hand knowledge, I'm saying I don't know how I can reconcile what might appear to be an inequity between my own two nephews, and I don't think Senate Bill 1 addresses that issue. With that, I conclude my remarks. Thank you very much.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. And this is not directly on your testimony, but could you tell me from the experience your company, which has a number of employees, and where there has been coverage, how many of these are mental problems of a genetic or a developmental nature, as opposed to how many are in the A and D class and more experiential or environmental?
It's really impossible to answer, mainly because of the privacy laws. We generally do not know whether it's medical or behavioral or substance. Frankly, in most cases, I legally really don't know very much about what actually is going on.
You know, I've had just a real problem that I've never been able to get enough information on in terms of mandates as a whole. And I'm not talking about mental health parity in particular, but just mandates as a whole, and thinking that, you know, as people argue about how much a particular new mandate that we might add in this assembly every session might cost, you know, people say, oh, it's only 1%, or it's only 0.25%, or it's only 2%, or whatever the percentage is. And the percentage, the way the percentages are bandied out in such a cavalier way, it doesn't recognize the callousness of the way that sounds when you compare the, what we know, that people will lose health insurance coverage for all the, you know, for every additional percentage or 2% or even 0.25%, some people will lose coverage. And the reason why I bring this up here is because I want to ask you, as members of the Associated Oregon Industries, who represent, I don't know how many thousands and thousands of small employers, large employers, medium employers, but just, you know, as representatives of businesses, what's your sense of that? And we're gonna, you know, as we work through this mental health parity issue, you know, this chair is gonna demand that we have, you know, good information about what the ramifications of this bill is gonna cost people. But, and we'll work through those issues, and everybody will have a different perspective, surely. But, you know, I mean, let's not underscore the fact that people will lose their health insurance. And so, even beyond the question that I asked you, and looks like, Lisa, you're ready to answer, you know, I have the question of, for the proponents of this bill in general, you know, are they prepared to accept the fact that, yes, okay, we can add this mandate, and prepared to accept the fact that if we decide that it's 0.5% or 1%, that thousands of Oregonians are going to lose coverage?
Mr. Chair, AOI, as I think you might know, we have a health purchasing co-op that's for small employers, and we have an actuary that does work for us on our own health product. And the estimates that he's given us for our trust are higher than the estimates that you've gotten here. But we use the estimates that the carriers have been able to calculate based on their experiences in other states. But one of the reasons our actuaries indicated to us that he believes the impact would be more on our AOI health choice is because he believes a couple of things will happen. He believes there'll be direct marketing, and that there will be more marketing efforts. Because right now, if you pass Senate Bill 1, we, as I understand it, don't have some of the facilities that would be necessary for a lot of the treatments. One that comes to mind is for children who need inpatient treatment, that it's my understanding that there's a shortage of facilities that provide that kind of thing. If you pass this and people are looking where they can go and set up, you'll be able to attract the industry in, and there will also be marketing to it. And so that's not, and I'd be happy to try and get my actuary to come in and talk to you about it, but he had told us last session on the similar bill with the amendments that it would have a higher impact on our group because of where we would be starting from. So that would increase the number of uninsureds.
Chair Dalto, if I might just add one thing. Our experience has been largely based on California, but a few other states, and looking at the situation in Oregon. I think one of the reasons that anybody who tries to analyze the predicted costs, particularly of this proposed set of benefits, involves a way that costs within the healthcare system are accounted for generally. And I'll just give you one example that relates to this. If I go to a general practitioner doctor, I go to a family doctor, see him, and I told my doctor, I'm feeling kind of depressed and down all the time, my doctor might well prescribe some form of antidepressant for me today. Happens all the time to lots of people. It would not be registered in the context of mental health treatment, and the cost of that prescription drug is just going to be get registered in most accounting systems as a cost of prescription drugs. The cost of the prescription drugs related to various forms of treatment, it's very difficult to identify when you say so many million dollars are spent on drugs. You don't know very well why was that drug prescribed. Was it the course of mental health treatment? Was it the course of medical treatment? And that makes it really difficult to get a true cost picture because you really don't know how to allocate costs for things like prescription drugs to different forms of treatment, whether it's physical or mental. And so I think there's some real difficulty in trying to make real hard decisions about true cost. Why in my testimony when I said my best guess in California, that's the reason I always use the phrase best guess, because frankly it's really hard to get a very firm fix on those numbers.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you motioned.
Motion, I'm in about ready to leave.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Is John Holmes here? John Holmes and Linda Adams? Okay, welcome back.
Chair Dalto, members of the committee. My name is John Holmes, for the record, Executive Director for NAMI of Multnomah County. I'm here just to offer some perspective. I wanted to let you know, too, I moonlight as a philosopher and ethics teacher at Portland Community College, so I enjoy arguing and presenting arguments, and I've enjoyed the discussion here today.
Philosopher?
Yes.
I thought they were all dead.
Not yet. Not quite. I do appreciate the concerns over costs that have been raised, and I think what's important to focus on here is that the Oregon data we have is something that we need to, I think, focus on seriously and take a look at how that will play out. The PEB data, I think, is the most relevant data that we have in Oregon, and I think it would be important, and I'm not pretending to know this data, as philosophers often don't know bunch of facts, but I think what is important to look at is that we look at where these other small group insurance plans are, these private plans are now in terms of their mental health benefit, and compare that to where PEB was before it started the parity, introduced parity, and see what we can anticipate as a result of that. I don't think it's appropriate to be comparing other states' data to Oregon insofar as it would be possibly be starting at a different level. And so if we can get a better understanding of where the Oregon insurance plans are now currently that would be affected by this, compare that with the PEB data, I think we'd get a better read on what kind of percentage we'd be expecting to see as an increase. Secondly, just some comments about other market factors that may come into play as a result of offering parity. Speculation can be had a number of areas with regard to marketing costs, but I think certainly one of the things that faces families that struggle with this is there really isn't a need for marketing when you're looking for health coverage for your child who needs inpatient care, for example. You don't have to pick up a phone book and look for a marketing ad. You search that stuff out because that's how important this is to family members. You don't need an extra brochure sent to your house. You don't sit and wait for it to show up. You make an active call on your own, and it doesn't depend on a piece of marketing to do that. And I think the inpatient children's example is apropos of how families deal with this. So I don't know that speculating about marketing costs is appropriate with some of these major mental health issues that families are facing. With that, I will conclude and entertain questions if needed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, my name is Linda Adams, and I'm a former state worker with the DHS and Children's Services, Child Welfare. Worked for DHS for 27 years. And I worked in ways that over years and years of working with children who have been abused and neglected and dealt with the limiting of mental health treatment for them and trying to get them into appropriate treatment. And I want to lend my support to all the previous speakers who've done adequate jobs at representing those issues. But I, you know, I listened to remarks about cost. You know, those kids grow up. They may have treatment now as a child, but they need treatment as an adult. They need treatment at different stages. The appropriate treatment for a 4-year-old is not going to be the same for a 25-year-old. And the ADHD child is going to be an ADHD adult who's going to self-medicate himself up there on the streets. And if they don't get drug and alcohol treatment, they're gonna get treatment one way or another. It could be by burglarizing your home and buying meth or whatever else they use. But, you know, that's one side of this issue. Another side that I wanted to bring up is the fact that if this state can pass an assisted suicide law, why can't it pass a law that says that people are equal to mental health treatment for depression, no matter how long? Because people with chronic illnesses are depressed people, and they suffer on a long-term basis, and they should have the same access to treatment. And as a person who has had, was involved in a serious car accident and had multiple spinal injuries and have to deal with chronic pain all the time, and I see a lot of people with chronic pain injuries. And we talk about PEV and its parity. Well, let me tell you about some of the parity that's going through the system where standard insurance takes if you have a long-term disability claim. And because there's lack of parity in this state, and they combine, if you have any kind of treatment for depression, a head injury, anything, and you have a physical injury, they combine the mental health with the physical and limit your claim. And then you will lose your health insurance and everything else because you have a physical injury. But if they can bring up one mental injury, one thing, and combine it, they can limit that claim to 24 months. That's a fact. And until we have parity, that disadvantage will continue to happen. I will be submitting some further written documentation to the committee, but as a citizen, as a person who's gone through the system and sees the discrimination, I think the board needs to be aware of that side of it too.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you both. All right, we have the gang of three from Blue Cross, from Regency, to finish up the testimony. Pamela Alley, John Powell, Elise Brown, is that? That's the end, I think, right? Are there any other, is there any other testimony that come before us today? I think these are the last three witnesses we have on our list. We're anxiously waiting for you.
We're ready to begin.
Go for it.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Elise Brown, representing America's Health Insurance Plans. AHIP is the national organization representing HMOs, PPOs, and other network-based health plans. Our member organizations arrange for health care services for approximately 170 million members. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today on the important issue of insurance coverage for mental health care services. AHIP recognizes that behavioral health treatment is an important part of overall health and well-being of our members. However, we are concerned that adding yet another mandate to our state's extensive list of mandates, which we've mentioned today is currently at 25, would keep healthcare costs escalating, making insurance less affordable and add to the numbers of Oregonians who are uninsured. I wanted to highlight a couple of specific concerns, and I hope not to duplicate. I think the biggest point to emphasize today is that these proposals will not guarantee mental health coverage to all Oregonians. Again, they do not guarantee coverage for individuals or self-insured policies. And they do nothing to help the population with the greatest need. That is the uninsured, the Medicaid population, and our prison population. And this is a really tough one for me, personally. Many today have shared their personal stories about how mental illness has hit their family, and it's hit mine. I have a sister who became mentally ill at the age of 24. She's 44 now, currently on the Oregon Health Plan, thankfully, and she receives great benefits. But if she were to lose those benefits, today's proposals would do nothing to help her. Number two, Oregon already has a mental health mandate, and it's helping a great number of people. One of the recommendations that was made today was looking at the option of increasing that existing mandate. Third, benefit and parity mandates increase costs, and we've talked to that. It's just bottom line, that's what happens. Every mandate adds its own cost and collectively has a significant impact on increasing health care costs. Mental health parity is expected to increase claims in Oregon about 2.5%. Fourth, benefit and parity mandates limit consumer choice. As the health care costs continue to go up, it's important that insurance plans have the flexibility to design benefits that meet their customers' needs. Mandates limit that opportunity, and you're asking people to buy plans that have benefits that they necessarily won't need or never use in their lifetime. Increased costs associated with these proposals will lead to many employers dropping coverage, we heard that, thereby reducing the access to current mental health and other health care services. So rather than benefit consumers, overexpansive benefits will narrow or eliminate benefits altogether at a time when we are debating how to expand access to our rising number of uninsured Oregonians. I thank you for the opportunity to comment today, and Regents will elaborate a little more on the ERISA laws that have been brought up and also walk you through the PEB data. Thank you.
Yes, I'd like to ask you a question. Do you have the bill in front of you?
I do.
Would you take a look at page 4, lines 25 through 29? I've been carrying on a little bit about managed care here. If you feel comfortable that those provisions give your plans, which I assume because the definition of a group health insurer means an insurer or health maintenance organization or a health care service contractor, if you feel comfortable that if the mandate is in place, that section gives you all you need to integrate managed behavioral care services as a part of this benefit? John, you might be prepared.
John might be able to answer.
Mr. Chairman,
members.
Sure.
Just hold that in the background for all of you to think about as you're testifying.
Oh, sure. Member of the committee, my name is Pam Lally, and I am with Regents. And I'll address Representative Greenwick's question, if you don't mind. Actually, Regents has been heavily engaged in conversations regarding mental health parity in the state of Oregon for some time. And some of you may remember that in 2003 session, we took the unusual step of actually working with those who are proponents of drafting the bill to try to come up with some language that would mitigate the financial impact should it pass in 03. And the Section 1, Paragraph 8 language that you referenced, Representative Greenwick, is a result of those conversations. And it does reflect the same type of cost management tools that we're able to apply on the medical side of our business today.
So you're feeling pretty comfortable with that?
Yes, sir.
Good.
I'd like to echo Elise's comments about Regents' respect for the importance of mental health and behavioral health treatment in the overall health of our members. And you've heard many compelling stories here today. And my concern is that there may be a misunderstanding or an overstatement of the ability of the proposal in Senate Bill 1 to address the concerns that have been raised.
we've heard stories about someone whose child was in an inpatient facility and had $50,000 worth of bills at the end of that time. This bill does not reduce those charges. It simply insulates those who are fortunate enough to be covered under a fully insured commercial health product from those costs. It doesn't address the root cause. And that's just one of the examples I can give. When I talk about the ERISA law, for those of you who may be confused about what sounds like contradictory testimony that you heard today, if I'm following the gentleman's comments earlier, he's referencing a law that was passed a couple of years ago at the federal level that includes a cost threshold that says that if a company can demonstrate that mental health parity could be implemented at an impact of less than 2%, then an ERISA plan will be compelled to include mental health parity. And to date, no plans have been able to demonstrate that. Therefore, there is not a straight requirement that ERISA plans incorporate mental health parity, and I want to be careful that you understand that. And I think you all already understand that ERISA plans are not required to implement state mandates. I'd also like to make comment on Mr. Pine's remarks regarding the California parity law and the impact it's had on the ESCO Corporation there. He referenced an estimated minimum impact of 2%. You should know that the California law is slightly different than what's being proposed in Senate Bill 1. Number one, it's a biologically based model, therefore it's not full parity of all mental and behavioral health conditions. And number two, it does not address chemical dependency at all. So if California were to reflect the same requirements being referenced in Senate Bill 1, no doubt ESCO Corporation would see anything greater than 2% impact on their costs. Also, there may be an assumption that all groups covered under a commercial carrier such as Blue Cross have fully insured products, and I just want to be sure that you understand that just because someone is covered under Regents doesn't mean that they're covered under a plan that is subject to the state mandates. In fact, our group of business for groups over 25 are about 50-50, and those groups who choose to have their own self-insured product and to assume full risk may choose not to incorporate all of the state mandates. So of our group business, only 50% would be subject to the mandates referenced in Senate Bill 1. There's also been a lot of comments about the PEB experience, and I've heard a lot of reference to the percentage of one. And I'd like you to understand, as best as I can explain it, the arrangement that Regents made with PEB when they went to full mental health parity. First of all, PEB was not at the current state-mandated level of benefit. They had already made a decision several years ago to offer a higher level of benefit to their members. And Regents had accepted full financial risk, full financial responsibility for claims incurred related to those benefits. When PEB approached Regents about implementing full parity, the agreement was made that PEB would set aside 1% of total premium dollars in a side bucket, if you will, and they would assume the risk for any members who exceeded the previous benefit level. And as I walk you through some information about the number of members who utilize their mental health benefits, it may become clear why some may assume that because PEB's expense out of their own bucket was less than 1%, there may be an assumption that the total increase was less than 1%. But all we're saying is that they needed to use fewer than 1% of those dollars to compensate for those who used a greater amount of benefits than would have been covered under their previous benefit level. At Regents, fewer than 0.2% of our commercially covered members accessed their mental or behavioral health benefits at all over the last 2 years. Of those 0.2%, it should be noted that those who chose to access inpatient benefits, over 90% of them, in other words, over 90% of them were able to complete their treatment plan before they had exhausted benefits. They still had benefits available to them under the current mandate of state-level benefits. And those that didn't reflected fewer than 200 of nearly 1 million members. The most commonly used mental health or chemical dependency benefit is outpatient. And of those who utilized that benefit, over 98% were able to complete treatment before their benefits were exhausted. And those who accessed residential services, which can be some of the most expensive care received,
99.9% of our members who access residential treatment services completed their treatment prior to exhausting their benefit levels. So I just would like you to keep in mind what the need is that's being addressed by the bill.
May I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
I missed this presentation. The document.
I don't have it, and I understand she was not here. She was represented by someone else.
Oh, Damiana submitted it. Well, it says in here, right under giving the Blue Cross tables and the Regency and the Kaiser tables for those before and after. In 2003, 3% of PEB members utilizing outpatient services, 57% of the PEB members utilizing residential care, and 15% of the PEB members utilizing inpatient care exceeded the 2,000 limit. Those were large numbers, but small bases.
In order to fully comprehend the percentages, I think it's important to know what numbers are represented, because sometimes 57% equals two people.
Those are of the ones that exceeded 2,002.
Those who accessed their benefits. It's not as I understand what you
those
just said.
Exceeded the 2000. These numbers are of those who exceeded the 2002 base. So, would you say that was about 200 that exceeded the?
I'm sorry, I don't have the numbers for PEB. In the way that you're stating them, I was reflecting our commercially based business.
Exceeded. You said about. Did you say about 200 exceeded the limits?
Fewer than 200.
Of your whole business.
Of those who accessed those in the commercially. Insured, so the fully insured business, not PEB, fewer than 200 of those who accessed a particular type of benefit, which was the inpatient benefit. Because there are three categories.
I'm sorry. Yes, thank you. I got it.
I'm sorry.
Yes, please.
We have a chart that will demonstrate for you if you'd like to see it. The difference between our commercial membership and our PEB membership in terms of utilization and exhaustion of benefits. And we'd be happy to share that with you if you would find it beneficial. So in closing, I would like to thank Representative Greenlick for driving home the point that should you decide that it is, in light of all the facts that have been shared, should you decide that it is, in fact, in the best interest of public policy to pass Senate Bill 1, it's imperative that the cost containment language that Representative Greenlick has shown the light on remain in this bill as it passes through. Otherwise, the cost impact to the greater community will be much greater than 1 or 2%.
Thank you, John.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell.
Last but not least.
Yes. Or least and last. I represent Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, and I just want to make a few comments. We are thankful and want to acknowledge the ability to work with many of the proponents, both legislators and advocates, in drafting the provisions of Senate Bill 1, and you should know that the other bills pending here before your committee are identical to Senate Bill 1 with the same language. And specifically, we are grateful for the management language that's in the bill. At Representative Greenlick's admonition, I will look at that language regarding the potential of pharmaceutical benefits. I want to say that the PEB example, I think, is extremely important for all of us to understand. It is, I think it is misquoted many times, not intentionally, because these numbers are hard to understand, and as we're in this discussion, you start splitting numbers into small, very small groups of people, and percentages mean different things to different people. And I do think it's important when we talk about the issue of parity, that the bills you have before you are really full parity. Other states are used as examples, and when you compare a parity from the different states, they mean different things. Pam gave you one example of California law. Maryland is often cited. But in Maryland, I believe after the 12th outpatient visit, the copay is 50%. So when you say parity, it means different things. In the PEB plan, as I understand it, according to the information that PEB has produced, the Regents plan, while it has unlimited outpatient benefits, still has a 45-day per 12-month residential limitation to it. So again, there is something short of, again, what some might call full parity. So the term parity itself is different, and what it would cost is different. And then you have this concept of going to parity. Where are you starting from, and what is the platform that you're moving from to get to that total cost? Again, PEB has been used as costing in this first year 4.6 tenths of 1%, so a little bit less than one half of 1%. But the base that came from is full parity for chemical and substance abuse. That was adopted in the year 2000 by PEB. So that's been in the PEB plan for several years. In addition to that, the mental health benefit had been bumped up substantially prior to going to parity. So the difference in cost in that first year is much smaller than it would be for the average commercially insured group who is now going to parity. And that's why, under the conservative estimate that Blue Cross has provided you with, is 2.5% of claims costs. So that is what we consider to be a conservative estimate. And our role here is hopefully to be a resource as you move forward in the discussion of this issue. And we want to make sure that there is a very clear understanding. The information that you were handed today has been provided to your office. You should have this in your file. And what we hope this provides is at least some very, very basic information on what we're talking about and what this bill would do. About $20 million a year for Regents members will be added to the cost of health insurance under this proposal. So again, we want to be a resource, and we want to be a constructive resource as you move forward in these discussions.
President Brown.
I guess that, and I understand the business point of view, I understand the insurance point of view, we're hearing a lot about costs and how that will affect people, both on your end and both on our end and both on anybody's end. But what I'm not hearing here today is that this is something that's part of our body. I don't hear you excluding services for lung problems. I don't hear you excluding services for a heart problem. I don't hear exclusion for intestinal problems. When someone's ill and has a disease or whatever, cancer, you know, there are limits on some coverages overall and stuff, but we're talking about brain and other electronic things, and then some, you know, and I don't know exactly the percentage of the brain that we understand. I'm sure it's quite small. But, you know, it's like, how do you cover someone's soul? I mean, do we even talk about a soul here? But that's what makes us live, I think, in addition to some chemical mix and stuff like that, water and air. But I don't understand why this piece of care and health care is excluded from coverage and from acknowledgement, and why it has a social stigma, if you will, and why everybody's focusing in like ants on just money. Because what it does and how it can affect someone is exponential. And in terms, it affects businesses, because if they lose a person who goes off on their medicine for so long and starts affecting their coworkers and customers and whatever, and maybe does something with your computers that might cost you a lot of money, whatever that is. And there's all kinds of mental illnesses that we're just beginning to get a grasp on, and also even acknowledge that they exist. So, and they can affect people, places, things, businesses, homes, whatever, and families. And I just can't understand why the mental part is divided out and treated differently.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boone, I think none of us would disagree with your comments. I think historically, major medical insurance started out based on a hospitalization model and what we would call a medical model separated from or a mental health treatment model. So some of this is simply historical. But to go back to your heart situation, the heart 25, 30 years ago, maybe more than that now because I'm getting older. I used to say that and that was a long time ago. But before open heart surgery and before stents and before angioplasty, all of those procedures, what did it cost to treat the heart? Zero. You died and they buried you. And health insurance for the heart was very cheap. It's no longer very cheap. All of the major medical diseases now are very, very expensive to treat, and thus these costs have skyrocketed, and the price of insurance is the single determinant as to who has it and who does not have it. That is the issue. That is the issue almost exclusively. Why doesn't the state cover everybody who's poor with the Oregon Health Plan? It's money. So we don't want that to be the case. I wish it was free. We're not here saying don't, under any circumstances, do this. All we're saying is there will be consequences. Some people will have nothing. They won't have their heart covered. They won't have their appendix covered. They'll have no coverage. So this is just like the Oregon Health Plan. There is no difference, except different people make the decisions. We don't make the decisions. We offer the products. People who pay these dollars are going to make the final decisions, whether it's the employer or, as you've heard earlier, and in a growing number of cases, it's the family. Can we afford, out of our budget, to cover the spouse of the worker and the children? And in growing numbers, no, is that answer. So it is a matter of cost. It is not a stigma. Regents and our testimony and things we've handed in fully acknowledges the benefits of mental health care and treatment. It is very much a part of health care, and we acknowledge that. It is how we get to the best benefits within a policy that's possible. The same could be said about autism. Families that have autistic children are rocked to the bedrock, and there are limited benefits for that. The same is true for a brain-injured person in an automobile accident. There are limited therapy benefits in a health insurance policy for that benefit. And so there are other limitations that are placed in there so that you can spread as many benefits across as the largest number of people possible. And that's true with the Oregon Health Plan and the budget process in this building, and it's true with commercial insurance. So I think that is why cost rises to the top. It's not that it's this dollar over that dollar. It is, when is it that last dollar that people lose coverage? And can you have more modest benefits and cover everybody or close to everybody, or are you going to have Cadillac benefits that a smaller number can enjoy and appreciate? So I think that's as good of an answer as I can give you. And it may not be the best answer.
Can I just ask him one more to tweak it a little bit further? As to, for example, let's just then take diabetes and bipolar disorder. How do you differentiate, you know, X number of times to meet with your therapist or your doctor with those two? I mean, and I guess I would have to say if they were treated the same, wouldn't the concept of how to heal the person and get them better be rather than the, you know, cost per session? I guess that's where I'm having a problem with
Mr.
that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boone, I think in a utopian world, the answer would be yes, there should be no difference in terms of, and this debate in healthcare goes from disease to disease, and it goes from provider to provider. What if I feel better getting a massage than going to see my general practitioner? If I get the flu, maybe for me, a massage makes me feel better than what the MD can do for me. But there are limitations, whether you go this way or this way with individual ailments, whether it's a brain injury, whether it's autism. And in a utopian world, there would be no differences.
Mr. Chairman, may I just comment for a moment?
Yes, sir.
And if we have a hearing on HR6, I'll be covering this. But, you know, there is a very interesting, when you look historically, basically nobody had health insurance prior to the end of World War II. So health insurance alone is about 60 years old. And when health insurance started at that time, it was basically hospital coverage. Blue Cross was started essentially by hospitals who weren't able to get paid during the Depression. And so health insurance when we started was basically hospital insurance, and physician insurance came out after that. During that same period, there was only two kinds of mental health treatment. One was fancy psychoanalysts for rich people, and the other was basically hospital care that was a state problem. And basically, when I started working for Kaiser in 1965, all mental health services were excluded because it was viewed at that time as a state problem. It was supposed to be taken care of by the county or by the state. Well, you know, that soon died, but the notion that, I mean, it was literally excluded from health insurance plans, any mental health coverage at that time, and it was only 40 years that we started covering Medicare and Medicaid. I mean, that's only 40 years ago in my career in Portland in that time that we started Medicare and Medicaid. So we started taking care of poor people. And it's just been overcoming those barriers because everything takes an incremental change. So it started with a little bit of coverage, and it started with a little bit of outpatient coverage. And then the notion of, oh, how could we possibly treat hospitalization? Well, the states failed us, so we don't have any other way to do it, and it's come more and more into health insurance. But it's not, I think, a sort of evil. And we need to get there. We need to get there to integrate care. There's no question about that. But and this is about the last piece, I think, that we need to put in place to do it. That's what makes this important. I mean, it is, I think, the last piece. I did want to put in the record, Mr. Chair, that I chaired the Institute of Medicine Committee on trying to improve substance abuse treatment. We issued a book called Bridging the Gap in substance abuse treatment. I saw it. Ann Uler here before was involved in that whole process, and that has changed the way we begin to look at substance abuse. We did point out in that book that failure to have parity for substance abuse services was the biggest single barrier to getting proper state-of-the-art treatment into substance abuse. Since then, we've known there's another barrier. It's the failure to Medicaid to be able to, you know, we dropped 70% of the outpatient treatment out when we give up OHP standard. But this is important, it's coming, I think. And I think it's very important what John said. There are consequences to it. We need to make sure as we do this, we tweak it very carefully so we can do it if we do it in a very systematic way, in a way that allows people to control the cost so we don't break the bank and still get the services that people really need to be. But I'll talk more about it next Wednesday if I have to.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you offered that perspective, Representative Greenlee, because I just think trying to put it in the perspective of Representative Boone's concerns. It is an evolution of how we've been able to treat mental illness, people living with mental illness, and the fact that as the treatments are more and more effective, people are able to be more productive and be out there and live and work and be prosperous in life, I guess, with mental illness. And so
And there are more and more treatments that look like diabetes treatment. I mean, it is pharmaceutical far more than it ever was before.
That's interesting. Representative Anderson, you had a comment?
Thank you. Yeah, this is not the time to be philosophizing, but...
Well, we have a philosopher in the room.
I think,
we have a life philosopher and a semi-life one.
Semi-moribund right now. I agree in many ways that we've gone from zero to 100 since 1955 to 2005 in the coverage of health care. I think we're going to need a whole new revamping of our system, because while I very much think we need to include parity, mental parity, I think we need to exclude a number of things that we're paying for now, because people cannot continue to pay $1,500, $2,000 a month. We're not going to see any coverage at some point in the line. And what I'm getting at is that I think we need, you know, I've seen patients in my practice where they have prevented nothing. They come in, they get all the treatment, pay for it, and go out and do nothing to help themselves. Those patients don't deserve to be covered. They should pay a price for not being willing to take care of themselves. I think we need to look at overeating. I think we need to look at people who will not take care of themselves for diabetes or for heart problems.
Skiers.
Skiers. That's a little different category. But the point is, we're covering everybody regardless of how much they're bought into the system. And at some point, we have to back up and say, yes, you can be covered, but you have to buy into the system yourself. And maybe we can get the cost back down into $300, $500 a month by opting out people that will not help themselves.
Can
I just add, I know, Billy, and I'm late for my doctor's appointment right now. So.
Go ahead.
But I just want to say something on top of what Representative Anderson said. And I had an epiphany not too long after we started this process, and that is to just go backwards on that. Doing the same thing is to have the premium reflect the level of prevention that people take in their lives, and give them have incentives and say, if you can, then you have to be evaluated, of course, by your physicians, whatever, or your massage therapist, and as to how well they're doing, and so their premiums, people who would cost you less in the long run, their premiums would be less, and it would take off a little bit on that, too. Put some responsibility on people to do that. So, and I would like to exclude skiing from that, because I do.
The most important choice that an individual makes is the choice of their parents.
Of their parents? Oh.
And if you really want to raise people, you need to raise them on their genetics.
Representative Anderson, could you give us possibly 5 more minutes? Because I think there's just one more person. Sure. So, did you all have a chance?
We did.
Okay, thank you very much. And I just have one other person signed up. Judith, I'm sorry, Puratasi? Puratasi, okay.
I'll be very quick.
Okay.
I think my meter's expired.
Oh, geez.
It's only a very patient.
And it's $21 here.
Oh.
It's more expensive.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yes.
only
get one. Yeah. My name is Judith Puratasi. And I'm a member of NAMI, but more importantly, I'm a family member. And I've listened to the testimony today, and it is, I have a sister who is severely mentally ill. She became ill and around 15 years ago. She has an economics degree, and following her decline and descension into mental illness, she was recently hospitalized. She had insurance when she was married. She became divorced. And at the time, her insurance, the health insurance she had, I think it's kind of with irony, she worked for Blue Cross as an underwriter before she became ill. So it is with great irony that I'm here following Blue Cross in terms of their testimony. She became ill in the early 90s. She had inadequate coverage. The coverage did not cover proper treatment. She then, because of her illness, and I think it's a very typical situation, she became divorced, lost custody of her child,
lost her job. She hasn't been really gainfully employed for 5 years. And she has become, she became hospitalized while she was without insurance at a great cost to the state. She was hospitalized for 1 month, and that was in early 2005. A little bit of timely, cost-effective medication and therapy early on would have helped her at any point during this process. It did not. It failed her. I also want to say that I am a member of the United Church of Christ. I'm a member of a church in Wilsonville where we have, I don't know in your churches, but we have a segment of our service which is for prayers when members are hurting. I want to say during our last Sunday service, we had two people get up who are probably in their 60s, members, 60s, 70s, grandparents' age, get up. One of them said her grandson had shot himself, had just committed suicide in his early 20s from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. And the other one, they don't know the cause of death, also in the early 20s. There is something going on in our communities, and I think it's the stigma, it's the lack of insurance coverage. I know it in my family. I'm seeing it in our churches. I'm seeing it in our schools. And you can do something about it. We heard this morning, I just want to, I'm not an actuary. I'm not my sister. She knew all of these facts, you know, 15 years ago. I don't know these facts. We heard this morning, I think it was a small business owner who said she saw her insurance premiums rise 44% in 3 years. And I don't really recall who it was or what situation, but I don't think she's off. I think insurance, health insurance premiums for employers have been rising at double digits. And if, as we heard this afternoon, that for every percent increase in premiums, we're losing 3,000 people, I can't believe all of that is because there's parity and mental health coverage. It's because of the physical conditions that are now being covered under health insurance policies. And I would ask, how much, you know, if we're looking at 44%, how much of that was due to physical increases, and how many people have we lost to physical conditions? It isn't the mental conditions. And finally, I know everybody wants to go home. Finally, I would really, you know, you have listened so patiently and taken our testimony, and thank you, you know, Chairman Dalto, for scheduling this, because I came on Wednesday too and you scheduled it magically. You announced this hearing. It was providence. It just happened. I want to thank you for that. But I think I want to tell you from a family member's who's faced this from generation to generation, I don't want to see this again. I don't want to come back in 2 years. I am afraid my sister will be dead in 2 years. She needs help. Families in Oregon need help. This bill will affect tens of thousands of families and, you know, adults and children in our community. So you can do something about this. And I don't have the answers to your questions about percentage increases. I know we can find that data, but that's not the bottom point. I mean, that's not really the bottom line here. The bottom line is the brain is part of our bodies. We need to take care of that. We need to do something about it. You have the power to do something. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
The same question you asked earlier. May I ask a question? If we pass this today, would your sister have coverage?
You know, she worked for Blue Cross.
Oh,
no. Now, well, she has been uninsured. She's not employed. She's not employable.
So passing this is not going to provide coverage for her.
Right, but at the time that she, if parity had been in place when she started with her first psychotic attack, yes, it would have helped her.
She lost coverage.
She lost coverage because she got divorced. She was covered under her husband's plan. Correct. It would have helped.
Until she was divorced.
Well,
she could get remarried.
That would probably make her even worse.
All right. Thank you, Representative Anderson.
Thank you very much.
Do we get everybody? Is there anybody else that wishes to testify on this measure? Seeing none. We are going to continue this hearing to Monday, only so that we can allow Senator Westland to testify on Monday. He wanted to offer a perspective, so, you know, and maybe Monday if there's one or two other people that didn't get a chance to stick around here and they have something to say, we can figure that out. But, so I'm announcing, for the purposes of whatever we need to do for the clerk, we are continuing this till Monday. Does that work?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
What time are we meeting Monday at 9 again?
It's our meeting is at 8:30 on Monday.
8:30? Okay.
So we need, oh yes, and there is some testimony that needs to be entered into the record.
Do you want to do it verbally or do you want to
do it?
Let
me just look at it.
Yeah.
We have received some testimony.
The whole thing, please.
From Karen Cormack Jones here in Salem, an individual who is testifying in opposition to these measures, and we'll provide it for the committee and the public. So we've entered that into the record. Is there more testimony?
Yep.
We have also received
two emails.
Emails from Linda Dunn from NAMI, Oregon, in support of this measure. Kathy Savicki, who is a friend of mine here in Salem, in support of the measure. Helen Gearhart, I don't know her affiliation, but she's a resident of Beaverton, and she is in support of this measure. And the Oregon Psychological Association has provided testimony in support of this measure. We've been provided with an actuarial analysis, mental health and substance abuse benefits by the Oregon Medical Association. That was also provided by the American Psychological Association along with their testimony.
And that's all we have.
And that's all we have in terms of written testimony. So with that, we will close the public hearing on HJM 24, close the public hearing on House Bill 2913, close the public hearing on House Bill 3444, and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1. And seeing no other business come before the committee, we stand adjourned.
Good day.